Race to the Floor from Chevelle. That's our number one song. It's been our number one song for a month. The question is, can anybody knock them off? If you miss any part of the show, get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com. And make sure you download the free iHeartRadio app and listen to us 24 hours a day.
No matter where you are, I'm Carrie Kasem.
I'm Nikki Sixx, and we'll see you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF.
That's 313-298-9743.
Now, here are Peter and Julene.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. This is our final show of the year because next Sunday is Christmas, and
yes,
the one after that is New Year's. So big happy holidays to all of you.
And a happy new year.
Hi, Julene.
Hello, Peter.
Yeah, so we are changing the name of this show to Night Call, starring Julene Jordan with Peter Werby.
Is that what we're doing? What?
I look at Facebook.
It has a lovely ring to it.
I look at Facebook and I go, well, and you could say, hey, Pete, post some stuff yourself, which I don't know how to do it. I'm not even an administrator.
You don't even have the password.
I don't. I don't know how to do it. But you've been traveling. But let's give people the basics before we get your report on your trip to Fort Meade, Maryland, and the Bradley Manning rally and support effort out there. Phone number here is 313, and we're giving you this in case you're going, whoa, what's going on? What's the next song they're going to play? We'll play Christy. Is Christy coming in tonight? I forgot to look.
I'm not sure.
Let's say she will. Christy Lee will be in at 2 a.m. In the meantime, though, we got to talk some talk because this is the public service segment of WRIF's program.
Yeah, 40 years, going into the 41st year.
Yeah, so it'll be like half a century.
My God.
Something like that. Anyway, 313-298-WRIF is the number that gets you, the listener, on the air. And if you don't have any letters on your phone,
it's 313. Sorry, I was choking. 313-298-9743.
How rude of me. Here, you choke. I can talk. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com is our email address, and you can send us messages. We have a Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall, and we like likes. A lot of likes piling up
like
there.
Like us.
Yeah, like us, and you can get all the reports about Julene.
It goes back and forth, Peter. Now, listen, nothing is as cool as your trip to Cuba, okay? So I just went to Washington, D.C.
Oh, that was pretty cool. All right, why don't you tell us about it? Tell us who it was to support this, what's his rank? I can't remember.
He's a lieutenant.
Lieutenant Bradley Manning, who is accused under the Espionage Act of passing secrets to Julian Assange
of WikiLeaks
that released hundreds of thousands of U.S. diplomatic files, including some video. Were some pretty damning things.
Yeah.
So he's on trial now after how long? Yeah.
He spent 18 months in solitary confinement, and at first his conditions were so horrible. He got some help from, I think, Amnesty International, who said, hey, listen, you can't keep make a guy sit in a cell with the fluorescence on 24 hours a day naked and stand in front of people to be humiliated. They made him stand there forever. No bedding, no nothing, concrete floor for sleeping, and just some kind of a scratchy covering that there's no way it would even keep you warm.
Well, wait a minute now. Aren't you supposed to have a trial, then you get the punishment?
Exactly. And this is what, it's part of what the anger is all about.
Yeah, this is a real travesty.
Yeah, why I was there. Because he's a hero.
So how in the world did you, I mean, I'm saying this is so leading. I know the answer to this.
Go ahead.
So, Julene Jordan, how in the world did you wind up at Fort Meade, Maryland, at the site of the trial of Lieutenant Bradley Manning?
Well, there was a rally because his He finally got a hearing, and his hearing, and it's still going on, pretrial hearing, started on Friday. So there was a vigil Friday. I flew in, and then Saturday went to a rally that was about 3 hours long. We started at one end of Fort Meade, and then we walked to the other, to the entrance where behind those fences were, is the courtroom where Bradley Manning was inside. There were a lot of protesters who went inside and actually were able to watch the proceedings, or even from a closed-circuit television in another room. And they said they were treated well. They weren't made to stand outside at all. There was a heated trailer, and that the police and the military police were all very nice to them. So I was glad to hear that. And they were pretty cool with us as we marched. No, people, you know, are a little feisty in the protest world. They didn't want to get off the street. And so they'd scoot us back onto the sidewalk, and then all of a sudden, bam, we'd be back on the street again. And they finally gave up. I mean, we weren't doing anything. We were just walking.
Really? Yeah.
And they had cones set up as well. So I didn't understand why they even tried. We weren't getting crazy.
Well, the objection would be that here is a man who released these deep secrets of the United States that could have harmed people, that there may have been people even lost their life because of his turning over these files to WikiLeaks.
Well, yeah, that's what the argument the people who think he's a traitor to the United States are saying. But even higher ups in the U.S. military, there's not been one case that's been proven or brought to light that is the result of what he did. There has been nothing. And so,
just a lot of heavy embarrassment
on the part of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
So it was a great rally, and Lieutenant Dan Choi spoke at it, and he was the officer who was kicked out of the Army because he's gay, and that was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. Wow. And he spoke. Wow, Peter was just the most impassioned. It was like the Asian Martin Luther King. This guy, he was amazing, you know. And a lot of different speakers talking about Bradley Manning and the fact that the head of this rally, who was a GI and got out, I can't remember his entire story, but a very interesting guy. He set the whole thing up. He has led this campaign to raise money for Bradley Manning's defense money. And so far they've raised $175,000. Wow. So he can have this really, he's got a tough lawyer.
And isn't it, what's the website? I think it's
BradleyManning.org.
Yeah.
So if you want to check it out. And so I got interviewed while I was there, and
you went viral.
I went absolutely viral all over the world. Now, I didn't tell my Republican father that I went out to D.C. for this. I'm trying not to upset him in his kind of older age, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, I'm not going to tell him. I'll just scoot out there and I'll scoot back. I was only there. It was 36 hours, Peter. Well, I'm in almost every single major newspaper around the world, having been quoted by the Associated Press about my feelings about Bradley Manning and why I'm there and why I support him. And it's funny because I'm like, oh, AP, they interviewed a lot of people. They won't. There's a lot of people who know a lot more about this than me and they'll probably say it a lot more eloquently. Well, the entire world now has read my quote.
So that's incredible. I think, you know what occurred to me when I saw, you know what I want to do? I just want to take a little parenthesis here, and because we're not only going to be talking about this, and a lot of it will depend on you calling 313-298-WRIF if you want to talk about this or anything else. But here is also what we're going to talk about. There was a demonstration yesterday. Christian and Muslim religious leaders protested at Lowe's in Allen Park, the home improvement place, because Lowe's buckled in. I mean, you know, these corporations, either they are right-wing or they buckle to the right-wing anytime anybody says boo. And one whack-job right-winger posing as a whole group got Lowe's to withdraw its advertising. So there's been this enormous boycott, and we'll talk about that.
Okay, good. Now, wait, do you want me to lead into where I was going to lead in?
No.
No?
Also.
Okay.
This is very disturbing. And, you know, I thought this was terrible. Nearly one in five women in the U.S. survey say they've been sexually assaulted.
Ugh.
And the headline is misleading. It's actually much worse than that. And, oh, yeah, a war ended. So we're going to talk about all that.
Okay.
But let's continue. We're talking about Lieutenant Bradley Manning. He's on trial for releasing secret diplomatic cables. How in the world did he ever wind up possession?
He was an analyst.
So, I mean, does he dispute that he did this?
Well, he hasn't had a chance to say anything, Peter. That's the thing. Not one word has been spoken by him. And, he's in military prison, you know.
Yeah.
He's in solitary confinement. Anyhow, we'll see how that develops.
You know what struck me about all these WikiLeaks of all the diplomatic cables about how the United States, and I'm using this word intentionally, the United States Foreign Service, the State Department, the Defense Department, literally has tentacles that go all over the world, everywhere. Yeah. No other country in the world fritters away its fortune, and no other country puts itself and its people and other people in such harm's way. And if in any way Bradley Manning, the lieutenant who's now on trial for releasing these, if he inhibits the United States in I don't know. Have we learned any? We, maybe the people have. Have the political establishment learned anything? That where's the next? Remember in Avatar?
I still haven't seen it.
Okay,
Peter.
Well, maybe I made the point before, but Jake, the hero who would was an ex soldier, he had gotten crippled in the war in Venezuela.
Oh yeah, so, I've got to see this.
So when's the next war going to begin? But
yeah,
go ahead.
Where's it going to be? Also, I need to find this video. I went to Occupy Washington D.C. at Freedom Park, which was really cool. It was organized. It was amazing. I loved it. Okay. And
one of the few left.
Yeah, one of the few left, and they haven't been shut down. The city's working with them. I mean, Washington, D.C. is very used to protesters. So they're, sure. This is like another day, just another day, right? So went to that and got to see our friend David Rovitz perform. He performed for about an hour set. It was great. And then they showed the video that I have never seen. I can't believe I haven't seen this before. It's the video that Bradley Manning released. And it's of these soldiers shooting.
In the helicopter.
The helicopter gunship. Yeah.
Just shooting down these unarmed civilians.
Gunning down. Just gunning them down.
And making jokes.
And making jokes. And you can hear them talking. I'm going to try to find that and post that on our page because I hadn't seen that before. And I want to tell you what. I can't believe haven't had nightmares about it. It was absolutely horrible. So, it was a great weekend. Got to see Occupy Washington, which I've wanted to do. And the one thing I noticed in the airport, I flew into BWI, Baltimore, and even at Detroit, all the troops coming home from Iraq, they were everywhere. And I looked at this one young girl. I mean, she was 19. She had to be 19 years old. And she just had the look. It was a blank stare, Peter. It was...
Well, if you've been there.
Like, I know. Yeah. I felt so bad. I mean, I just felt like crying. I saw all these, and what I want to say to all of them, that I would never have done that because of just coming home, and I wouldn't probably do it anyway, but I wanted to say, you know what? It's such a pile of crap that you had to be there anyway. You never should have been there. You were there based on lies, but I just kind of kept it all inside.
A million men and women went through Iraq from this side.
God,
it's going to wind up.
It's
going to wind up costing us anywhere from $2 to $4.4 trillion. And one's always sort of circumspect, kind of careful when we're talking about the men and women that have put themselves in harm's way. I mean, they never, of course, the individual soldiers don't say, "Oh, I got an idea. Hey, guys, let's go over to Iraq, or let's go here, or let's go there." They're sent there by political leadership. And this is I'm trying to see where this is from Chris Floyd. I guess it's just chris-floyd.com. And if you were in Iraq, tell me what you think about this. This is pretty, pretty hard hitting. In March 2003, the United States of America launched an entirely unprovoked act of military aggression against a nation which had not attacked it and posed no threat to it. We all know that by now, right? There were no weapons of mass destruction, and we know that none of those war criminals in the Bush administration really thought they were. They sold it to you and I. They destroyed a nation, essentially. In fact, this says this act led directly to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent people. It drove millions more from their homes and plunged the entire conquered nation into suffering, fear, hatred, and deprivation. This is the reality of what actually happened in Iraq. Aggression, slaughter, atrocity, ruin. It is the only reality. There is no other. And it was done deliberately, knowingly, willingly. Indeed, the bipartisan American power structure spent more than $1 trillion to make it happen. It is a record of unspeakable savagery and abomination, an outpouring of the most profound and filthy moral evil. Now, if you were there, that's not how you'd like to have how you spent with your comrades in arms, the time there. It's not what you necessarily even thought you were there for. I mean, because we certainly have heard people talking, you know, returning veterans saying how they made a difference in people's lives, or they wanted to help villagers, or that they wanted to set up this or that, or they, you know, they realized how horrible Saddam Hussein was, and they were proud to be part of a process that eliminated it. But there is no way that the United States ever had the right to send anyone there. It was a crime against peace. George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, all of them are war criminals. They knew there was no weapons of mass destruction. I knew there was no weapons of mass destruction. Jeline Jordan knew there was no weapons of mass destruction. How in the world could people that actually had all of the intelligence believe it? They and the result is all of these dead Americans, all of these dead Iraqis, this this huge debt that we have that we never would have incurred if it wasn't George W. Bush's war and his tax cuts for the wealthy. Everything that we're suffering now is at their feet. And what happens to them? They make hundreds and thousands, in some cases millions of more, millions of dollars more. They're respected in some areas. They sell books. They go out on
book tours.
Henry Kissinger, who has warrants out for his arrest for war crimes in Vietnam and in Chile. I mean, this is 40 years ago, to the point where he won't go to France. He won't go to England. He won't go to
Spain. Many countries.
He certainly won't go to Chile, where he engineered a coup there. And he is featured on the front page of the New York Times book review section as an elder statesman.
Oh, God. You know what else the Iraqi people don't have? Still in many areas is working electricity, basic necessities like that. You know, we go in there and bomb the holy hell out of these people and their infrastructure. And we've been sold this pack of lies that we've been, that it's all fixed because it's not fixed.
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, I was mistaken. It's Private Manning.
Okay.
Which explains, I got an email from Jerry. Wrong word. And Kim Jong-il died.
He did.
Okay. I had to throw those things.
Right. And that was had nothing to do with Iraq.
Yeah.
That's from North Korea.
I just saw it right now.
And, here was a study from Defense News. And U.S. wars leave 225,000 dead, cost $4.4 trillion. Right? U.S. wars launched since the attacks of September 11, 2001 have left that number dead. The study published by Brown University this week focused on wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and counterterrorism campaigns in Pakistan and Yemen. The authors argue that governments almost always go to war, underestimating the potential duration. You know, a lot of you, if you were like 11, 12 years old when this began, I mean, you can vote and buy booze and get married and all that. You know, this is usually in Europe, they had things like the 30 years war and all that. Mm-hmm. And you go, wow, how could they have wars for 30 years? Well, this went on for 20 years. This was a 20 year war against Iraq.
God, it doesn't seem like 20 years.
Yeah.
We've been talking about this for 20 years.
And the study said an extremely conservative estimate of the casualty toll was about 225,000 people killed, 365,000 people wounded in wars so far. Number of soldiers killed comes to 31,741, including about 6,000 Americans, 1,200 Allied troops, 10,000 Iraqis, 9,000 Afghans, 3,500 Pakistanis, 2,300 U.S. private security contractors. The civilian toll was much higher, with an estimated 172,000, including 125,000 Iraqis, and some people think it's much, much more than that. 35,000 Pakistanis, 12,000 Afghans. And this goes, as many as 50,000 insurgents, 168 reporters, 266 humanitarian workers, and 7.8 million displaced persons.
Ugh.
Right?
Yeah, it's the largest refugee crisis in the world.
Yeah, and this could have been solved almost immediately. This criminal act by Osama bin Laden and his small band of right-wing religious fanatics, conservative religionists, if the U.S. military might would have been aimed at capturing him in the mountains of Afghanistan instead of lying about the necessity to go to war with Iraq, none of this would have happened.
And yet, Obama gets Osama bin Laden, and he gets, like, really no credit for it. You know? I mean, my God. But the, and the other thing, Peter, is that we, what we're going to, that we have to mention is that we are not out of Iraq by any means.
No.
There are still people, doing military training over there. There are still, many, many contractors. And we have to do something with that extremely large, permanent military base that we, they,
the
they
embassy,
built.
Which is the largest in the world.
The largest. It's a. It's
Why
a
would we want
one.
The largest in the world?
No, the biggest. We're number one, Peter.
Yeah.
Come
number
on.
One,
number one.
But we have left a. We've overthrown a dictator, right? But now we have Prime Minister Nuri Kamal al-Maliki, and who has moved swiftly to consolidate power, it says here in this, in advance of the American military withdrawal, offering a glimpse of how Iraq's post-American identity may take shape by rounding up hundreds of former Ba'ath Party members and evicting Western companies from the heavily fortified green zone.
Yeah, he's doing some corrupt stuff. He's not only doing that, he's also pulled Saddam Hussein and gone after the Ba'athists had them killed.
It's the fourth, Iraq is considered the fourth most corrupt country in the world.
I'm not surprised, and we contributed to that as well. We made it, it's the same.
Here is the lesson, folks. When President whoever, whether it's Obama or Romney or, you know, Jones or Smith in the future, when they get on there with the maps and the guys with the uniforms and the, you know, the former generals who are now a CBS military advisor, don't believe it.
Yeah.
Because if all you did was watch the cables or the network news, you go, yeah, they, I saw it. They have weapons of mass destruction.
God.
You needed to look a little further, and you knew it was all BS. You knew it was a lie. You knew they wanted a war. And why in the hell were we in a war that far from home to begin with? Remember, one of the things they said is that Saddam Hussein was going to put missiles on boats and put them off the coast of the United States, and they could launch... I mean, this is how mad it was, and this is what the media swallowed. This is the so-called liberal media.
And, and a lot of people bought it, and because they buy everything they say. You know, the other thing Maliki did was he fired 100 college professors in a certain area because they were of a different religion than him.
Yeah. Well, now the Shiites are running the joint,
right.
And they're closely allied with Iran.
Hey. Yeah. Hey, how convenient.
Okay, here's Jeremy from Detroit. You were there, Jeremy? You're on the air.
I know. I'm a former Marine. Yes, I deployed Iraq. I don't care what the whole issue of the war was. It just started becoming fighting for the person next to me.
Sure. You know what? That's in every war, though. If you're over there with your comrades in arms,
what else are you going to do?
What are you going to do? You got to stay alive.
I enlisted at 18 in 2006. Wow. I did not believe in the weapons of mass destruction. I went over there. I was following orders.
Yeah, we talk about that all the time, you know, even with situations like the occupations being shut down by the police. They're just being told by the city what to do.
You know, one thing that always I've wondered about, Jeremy, if you didn't think there was any real, you know, people were, a lot of people joined out of a real sense of patriotism, particularly after 9/11. And they said, you know, I want to go fight this menace. I want to end, you know, I want to bring the people to justice. I want to end the context of where this all began. Not feeling that and knowing that people were coming back either dead or severely injured, why were you willing to take that risk if you didn't believe it?
I believe in the country.
Yeah?
Yes, our leaders, they may be corrupt. They may be quoting you war criminals.
Yeah, but
I believe my country. I'm going to stand by my country. And if my country says, hey, we need to get this guy, I thought we were going after Osama. I thought we were going after Saddam. But we were going in and just basically wreaking havoc. Now, yes, people say we are rebuilding the country. We are. We are doing the hearts and minds.
Well, I don't think we've done too well. In fact, I was...
With all the money we've spent, it should be...
Here, this is from 100%. The Detroit News. Some Iraqis celebrated the exit of what they called American occupiers. Others said that though they were grateful for U.S. help ousting Saddam Hussein, the war went on too long. So, you know, it's I don't even, you know, what to appreciate. I mean, it's kind of hard to justify a process to get rid of a terrible dictator, as brutal as he was. You know, of course, that he was a U.S. ally. Saddam Hussein was. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, when you were in the Marines.
Buddies.
He went over there and he gave personally a pair of golden spurs as a gift of the United States to Saddam Hussein. And they, and the United States was running intelligence for Iraq during with Saddam Hussein's war against Iran.
Yeah, shaking hands, photo opportunities, the whole thing.
Well, I've noticed through history is America, we help out certain countries.
Wait a minute. When was this? Well, I mean, let's not buy the myths. When did the United States, I mean, sometimes the United States has given, you know, aid for tornadoes and earthquakes and hurricanes and, food aid and what have you. But, these wars, and we're going to, everywhere under the sun. Like here, I'm gonna stop you, and please don't mean to embarrass you on this, because 98% of the people listening aren't gonna know the answer to this, either. Why did the United States fight in World War I? Wow, right. Nobody, we just wound up in a war and everybody was real patriotic.
What an answer.
And they were, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I actually don't even know.
Well, no. But the people, the men went over there singing, over there, I'll be home when it's over there. And the United States was in that war for about 10 months only. You know, the war lasted from 1914 to 1918. And the United States got in April of 1917. We lost almost 150,000 men.
I mean, it was a brutal war. I don't see World War I veterans, but I know two World War II veterans. Well, I did. I used to attend a VFW. Before I joined the military, I'd help these men out. They're horribly traumatized, and I don't care the reason for the war. We fought a war in the name of our country. We did it for patriotism. We don't, on the ground level, and when we are out over there pounding dirt, we don't care about the cause of the war.
No, I know. I know.
We're doing
it
for patriotism. Basically, we're doing it following orders, and we believe thoroughly that they are a threat to our freedom.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jeremy, I should move on, but here's what you as an individual and the other people that fought with you and did what you were supposed to do, you deserve every benefit that the United States should offer, and probably more than that. And I know.
I hope they're helping you out.
Yeah, because what is going on now is all these vets are coming home and there's not going to be any jobs.
There's no jobs. That's right.
All right, Jeremy, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Heard one, imagine making jokes about this war, said the war in Iraq began with shock and awe and ended with a tweet.
Oh, my.
That Obama tweeted.
Oh, God.
Hey, we got a call from Florida. We should get Mike on. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Where are you in Florida?
I'm in Bradenton, Florida.
Okay.
Hello.
Of course, I'm from Birmingham, Michigan, so I'm calling from.
Oh, yeah. We've talked to you before.
Well, lots of times.
Yeah, that's what I've.
Anyways, just off the cuff, did you happen to hear that Christopher Hitchens passed away this past Thursday?
I did.
We did hear that.
Christopher Hitchens.
I watched a short.
62 years of age.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had cancer.
What? He had cancer, yeah. Author of the book God Is Not Great, which I happen to read. So.
Yeah, he was an atheist and all kinds of other things. I saw a really good interview with him.
What's interesting, Mike, a lot of religionists, mm-hmm. these sweet, loving people, were saying that God struck him down with esophageal cancer because he used his voice to blasphemy the Lord.
Right. There was an interview that I can't remember the guy. I watched it the other night when I was in D.C. With Christopher Hitchens. And it was after he had had his gallbladder removed.
Yeah.
And he looked, just real ill. And the interviewer asked him if he now, because he's an atheist, thinks, has changed his mind about religion. Is he asking God to save him? And, in a very intelligent way, he basically said, oh, hell no.
Yeah. Well, he, he drank a tremendous amount. That's one thing. He
right.
didn't wind up with esophageal cancer. But
anyways, what I was going to say was what I called for was because I guess over here in Bradenton, I've been reading the newspaper, or the local Herald over here. There's some police officer that was supposedly sexually molested a 15-year-old girl, and he wasn't even kicked off the police force. Even like she dropped charges because she was afraid.
Oh my God!
Because they have so powered. Now, the police department is so corrupt over here in Florida. I mean, incidents like this happen all the time. Police rape women. They sexually molest young girls, and they get away with it. And it's not right. It's not right.
Well, one of the things, it certainly isn't, Mike. Hey, you know what they say? You can take how's it go? You can take the boy out of Detroit, but you can't take the Detroit out of the boy. Right. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, that
all
is
right.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for calling in from Bradenton. You know, you're thinking about somebody else that used to call us. What was that guy used to call us from Bradenton?
Oh, no. I'm talking about
you remember, Mike?
Yeah. Right. I know who you're talking about from Bradenton.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, Mike brought up a good subject, and we're going to take a break. Fred, Tristan, the rest of you, hang on. There's a couple of open lines.
Yeah, give
313-298-WRIF. Nearly 1 in 5 women in U.S. surveys say they've been sexually assaulted, and I said earlier, that's a misleading headline. It's actually more than that. We'll talk about that and also the demonstration against Lowe's for pulling that ad from American Muslims when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Happy holidays. Welcome to REI. Can I help you?
Long list of people to shop for. First I need
a Patagonia down sweater.
Perfect. And then a pair of
Sorel Joan of Arctic women's boots.
Love it. And also a
REI Traverse 30 pack.
Well, that takes care of me. Now onto my list.
We know what you need and have all the outdoor gifts they'll love. With expert help in-store and online, we offer 100% guaranteed satisfaction with every gift you buy. Visit your local REI or REI.com. REI. Find out.
This holiday season, Lowe's is making it easier for you to give your grill master the perfect gift. Right now, save big when you purchase a Grillmaster 4-burner gas grill for only $149. That's a savings of $50. Plus, find other great values like a Black & Decker cordless screwdriver for just $29.97. Hurry, supplies won't last long. Lowe's, never stop improving. Offers valid 12/14/11 to 12/26/11.
Everything that rocks. Worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
And if you want to call us, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743, and I'm also reading your emails back at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Now, one of the things we said about the ending the war in Iraq, we're reading from a column by Chris Floyd. You can go to chris-floyd.com. He said, in March 2003, the United States of America launched an entirely unprovoked act of military aggression. That's quite a charge. Usually that's the charge the United States has against other countries. And an unprovoked act of military aggression against a nation which had not attacked it, we know that, and posed no threat to it. We know that, right? This act led directly to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent people. It drove millions more from their homes and plunged the entire conquered nation into suffering, fear, hatred, and deprivation. That's pretty strong stuff.
It sure is.
All right, so you want to comment on that? But also, the very disturbing study here at home, an exhaustive government survey of rape and domestic violence released on Wednesday affirmed that sexual violence against women remains endemic in the United States, and in some instances may be far more common than previously thought. Nearly one in five women surveyed said they'd been raped or had experienced an attempted rape at some point, and one in four reported they'd been beaten by an intimate partner. Jeez. One in six women have been stalked, according to the report.
I have a hard time even. I read the headline and I couldn't even read the rest.
The surveyors elicited information on types of aggression not previously studied in national surveys, including sexual violence other than rape, psychological aggression, coercion, and control of reproductive and sexual health.
Yeah.
So, in other words, these people that spend all of their time, rather than trying to fix the problems of the world and the community, go around trying to restrict a woman's reproductive rights.
Yeah. It's just so outrageous. I don't even get it.
But sexual violence affects women disproportionately. Well, we know that. One third of women said they'd been victims of a rape, a beating, or stalking, or a combination of assaults.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is men. I mean, let me talk to you guys for a minute. I mean, so two-thirds of us don't do stuff like that.
Right, absolutely.
Which is good.
Yeah.
But the fact that a third among us means that we're functioning within a culture extraordinarily violently to the point where women are afraid of us. And you say, oh, God, you know, women aren't afraid of me. I mean, I don't.
Yeah, we are. And you know what? I mean, this is kind of personal. I can't believe I'm really saying this, but I've been the victim of domestic abuse, and I've been stalked. So two out of those three, thank God I didn't have the third sexual assault to add to my list. But it's happened to me, and you know what? It is, like you said, it's very common.
And here, and I mean, I've said this before, and, you know, I'm a man saying this, but women have told me, women do not feel completely safe anywhere.
Anywhere. The only place I feel safe is when I go every summer to an area in the woods, and it's only women. It's private land,
yeah.
And it's a music festival, and that's the only place I feel
comfortable. Well, what I mean is, though, you feel safe right now, right? I mean,
yeah, with you.
Well, yeah, you can depend on me. I got your back for sure. But what I mean by that, a woman, let me put it another way, a woman alone, that's a better way to, a woman alone feels not 100% safe anywhere.
Sure.
Doesn't matter if you're in the richest neighborhood in the world, doesn't matter if you're on, you know, wherever. So, and here's the thing, for men that think that there is some justification for violence against women or threats against violence or dominating women, you are setting a cultural pattern for the women in your life as well. For your mother, for your sister, you know, for
your kids.
The girls who are your children, and it winds up like this. I mean, can you imagine this Vermont fraternity at the University of Vermont?
Oh.
They were suspended, thankfully, over a survey that asked members who they would like to rape, and they're also getting a visit from the representative of the fraternity's national headquarters. It's Sigma Phi Epsilon. And the organization, the national organization, said any behavior that demeans women is not tolerated, which is pretty good for a fraternity. Right,
right? Yeah,
we're,
I know. Those
we're happy
frat
about
rats.
That.
I never gravitated toward those frat rat types.
Who would you like? The greasers? The hippies?
Everything but the frat rats. And, you know, these guys, I kind of like some. I like the jocks and the hippies. Yeah, now that I got to think
that's
about
far
that,
apart.
I know. I'm very eclectic.
The Greeks don't like no geeks. You know, that's a
I
song.
I like the geeks too.
isn't that an Eagles song?
I don't know that song.
I think it is. Yeah,
I don't know
on
that song.
What's that with Joe Walsh?
But anyway, someone will tell us.
Yeah. But here is the deal. The fact that this group of fraternity members at the University of Vermont would pose a survey like that, who would you like to rape, means that they didn't occur to them. Like, they wouldn't say, who would you like to lynch, for instance?
Right.
Yeah, what African-American would you like to lynch? I mean, it's finally sunk into people's brains, or at least the majority of people in this country, that there's certain boundaries that shouldn't be crossed. But, again, these are college men and who have mothers, sisters, daughters, and who are, as being women, have a 1 in 3 chance of being sexually assaulted, raped, stalked, beaten, and what have you. And they are continuing the context in which this can happen to the women they love.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. I'm saying this every week now, that those feminists who said, in fact, never touch a woman without permission.
Yeah.
Never touch anyone else without permission.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a good rule to live by.
And you'd be okay. But that bitch,
deserved it.
Yeah, you know what? I'll tell you. When men tell me, and I understand losing temper in interpersonal situations, but...
tempers happen. That's
tempers
true.
Happen. But, you know, there's the old thing about you're standing waiting somewhere, right? And all of a sudden someone just slams into you, mm-hmm. and you just, this rage wells up in you. You turn around with your fist balled, and you realize that it was a blind man that did it.
Oh,
and suddenly,
right.
Whoosh, that all goes out. Or somebody says, get out of my way, and shoves you out of the way. And you turn around with your fist ball, and all of a sudden you're looking up a guy that's 6'4". And you go, you know, hey, why'd you do that? You know, I mean, you change. So in other words, it's an act of a bully. And the only time that the anger is able to manifest itself is when you're faced with someone who you can physically dominate.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's sure.
So don't
sure
do it.
Kid.
You don't want to be a bully. And it's within our culture, it's a terrible thing. And we want peace. Peace begins at home. Peace begins with you. I mean, there's a time for everything, and there is never a time for the act
of
hurting people that are smaller than you. I mean, I've had people say in terms of, you know, like fights between men, you know, guys mm-hmm. who do that, so punch
sure.
each other.
Sure.
They say, you know, hey, it's not an even fight. They say, who wants to be in an even fight? You have a 50% chance of losing. But
winning would be better, right?
But the brutality against women and children, that is absolutely intolerable to the point that, and you know, maybe those differences aren't as great as they were in generations past, but they still are. Most women are smaller in stature. I mean, tell me if I'm being not feminist enough or something
what?
Like that. But one of the things we're to do is to protect people that that often can't protect themselves.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm 5'2". And
you have eyes of blue.
And eyes of blue. And you know.
Hey,
about,
I'm telling you.
And about 115 soaking wet, you know. So I can't defend myself. I can't.
Yeah. So, yeah. And, well, all right. I think we made our point.
Yeah.
All right. The other thing is, I don't know how you've caught on to this, but a number of religious leaders, both Christian and Muslim, were out in Allen Park today, including elected officials, and they were angry with Lowe's, the home improvement center, because that the company withdrew its advertising on a program about Arab Americans, ones living in Dearborn, you know, our neighbors here.
Yeah.
So it was an interfaith protest at the Lowe's store. Dawood Waleed said, we're going to come back out again here, form our coalition, and we're going to boycott Lowe's until they make things right. He's the Michigan chapter of the Council on Arab-Islamic Relations. Now, this program called, what is it, American Muslims? Isn't that the name of it here? All American Muslim. It's on TLC.
Well, it got yanked, didn't it?
The show got yanked?
Yeah, it got yanked. Oh,
no.
Yeah. Yes, it did, Peter. Yeah, huh. Yeah.
Okay, we need some email
confirmation. Well,
I don't think
so. Yes.
Well, here's some moron. He's
thing on it on Friday.
He's counter picketing. He's got a huge American flag, and he says, "God bless America. God bless Lowe's." Now, why in the world?
What? God bless a corporation. You got, buddy. You got a problem.
Yeah. What a.
Sick. Here we go.
Yeah, man.
Canceled. News: All American Muslim show canceled.
Really? You Googled it or someone emailed you already?
No. I'm telling you, I heard this on NPR the other day. I'll get the actual. And Russell Simmons offered to come in and pay for it.
That's what I thought. I mean,
and save it. Go ahead and I'll find the example.
All right. Well, the right wing has such an amazing disproportionate power relative to their size in this country. And so, think about this. If there was a family about American Jews or American African Americans or
American Christians
or Christians, and some group said, I don't know why you're supporting those Jews. I don't know why you're supporting those Irish or something like that. They go, oh, no, okay, we'll take off. They would say, get out of here. I mean, why is this okay to do to people of Middle Eastern descent or that are of Muslim descent? I mean, this is pretty sick that it's even. Did you find it?
I'm still looking.
Okay. But you say you have found it, that it does say that it's canceled?
Yeah. But the thing about what I don't know for sure is if Russell Simmons has...
Saved it. Well, one of the things that this story that is in the Detroit News, doesn't say that there was something like the American Family Council. And it's one guy in Florida. He started this whole thing.
What's that?
The boycott to get the Lowe's to not advertise. One guy.
It's like that one preacher from... Was it
from
him?
He was from Florida.
Is this the same guy?
No.
So some other nutbag from Florida is coming up and messing with Dearborn?
Why do these guys do it? One thing that was pleasing. Do you remember... We did this last week. Remember, what was that woman from Alaska?
Oh, S.P.?
Sarah Palin.
Or P.B. Psycho bitch.
Yeah, no, well, Sarah Palin, remember like a year ago, all these liberals, they were just assured that fascism was coming to America, that the teabag was going to be these Nazi stormtroopers, that Sarah Palin was going to be elected president.
Oh, God.
And what have you. And now she can't sell her show. She's trying another reality show.
I know. She couldn't sell another. It was a stupid show, I think, about Todd out on his thing that he races out in the tundra. Oh, man. She's such a joke.
Well, the point being that and they never really were much more than this small, thin sliver of the American right wing that was mobilized by these big corporations that were essentially the cannon fodder for the Republican Party and the corporations. Mm-hmm. And they got so much play. They got so much money. They got so much media coverage. All right. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I need you guys to bear with me because I've had some dental work.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah.
That's not going to stop you, though, is it?
You're still calling. I like it. You're hardcore.
Well, I sound to myself like I got a mouthful of cotton or something.
You sound pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Well, anyway, I'm addressing this to guys like Jeremy.
Yeah, who called in. He was the Marine vet who was in Iraq. He said he didn't think there were weapons of mass destruction there. In other words, he thought the commander-in-chief was a liar, and as were his minions, but he said he was following orders.
Right. Now, I've never told you guys, but I served as a Marine from 75 to 79.
Okay.
And at that time, it was all about the Cold War and the North Korea agitating and all this kind of stuff. Now then, present day, I'm not here to cheer Obama, the Democrats, the mass media on, but I do believe that they are more on the right side of every issue than anything conservatives have to say.
Yeah.
And you can look at the reasons why we went in Iraq. You can read books like The Black Banners by the ex-FBI agent, Ali Safan, who told you that Bush and Cheney immediately tried to tie Iraq to Afghanistan and what they needed to do in Afghanistan. You can look at the Lowe's issue. You can look at the abortion rights thing. You can hear all the distortions these debates are bringing out in Republican candidates.
Yeah, it's amazing.
like I say, I'm not necessarily happy with everything that the media does, that the Democrats do. I have a million and one reasons why I would never vote conservative. You know, and you can look at the issue about this pipeline, for instance. Now, they're ready to throw all the money they can at that. I'm talking about the Republicans.
Well, let's not care
about the bridges, though, and the roads.
Now, that whole thing with this pipeline, that they, the Keystone Pipeline, is another subject. In fact, I'm going to bring that up around 12 o'clock. All right. Well, thank you. You've done admirably, even with oral surgery or whatever you had.
We got another email that the listeners are lower than us.
Okay.
You know how many years we've been hearing this? So
all right. Thank you, Fred.
I just want Jerry to know who's listening out there that we attempted to pot that up.
Pot
okay?
is an old-fashioned verb.
This has nothing to do with us. We can't. It started to distort when we turned him up a little more. And turning us down isn't the deal because we have levels.
Yeah.
And you have to have certain levels. It's very technical, Jerry. I'm sure you've got a clue about that. But
I'm watching these levels here. I mean, I'm hitting rate zero, right where I am. Talk to me. Give me the phone number.
313-298-9743.
Yeah. Well,
a little high? You're going to bring me down?
No, brought you up.
Good.
Okay. And that's where the callers look as well.
So yeah. So if not us, we don't know why it comes out that way online.
All right. A Chicago rally to thank Obama for supposedly ending war in Iraq turns up 30 speakers and 10 audience members. That happened in Chicago.
My God, that's so pathetic. That's so sad.
Well, people, and then about how many people there? 15 people counter-picketed. Saying the U.S. war in Iraq is not over. Obama does not deserve praise. Obama is continuing illegal and unjust wars. Obama is threatening free Bradley Manning. Yeah, Orambo. I like that. There's nothing to celebrate. So this was all about 25 people.
God, that's so sad.
Hey, I want to get Scott and Mike and Tristan and another Mike on the air. We've got to do some
spots right now.
Stay right there, and we promise we'll pump you way up.
Way as high as we can.
Yeah.
And also, we have just a couple of open lines, so if you want to call,
here's the number.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. And this is our final show of the year. Next Sunday is Christmas, and everyone is raving about politics on Christmas. And everybody's going to be too wasted or not even paying any attention to talk radio on New Year's Eve. Well, wait a minute. What is it? Would it be New Year's Eve?
Yeah,
it'll be New Year's Eve. Right.
We'll be partying down.
Yes.
No.
Well, I will. I don't know about you. Coming up in an hour, Gar Alperovitz, who's written a book called America Beyond Capitalism.
Ooh.
Reclaiming our wealth, our liberty, and our democracy. And also Michael Keegan from Don't Waste Michigan. You know, they're trying to build another nuclear plant on the site of Fermi 2 and Fermi 1. These people are crazy.
Yeah, and, boy, someone sent me something about some action down in Toledo. I got to look that up.
But if you go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, you get all the information about the guests, also about the end of the war in Iraq. Also, all the stuff about the Lowe's boycott. Let me see. Despite or because of Lowe's cowardice in the face of stupid bigots, ad times for the TLC reality series All American Muslim has apparently sold out, with hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons poised to buy any unsold time. Lowe's pulled its ads from the show after a Florida right-winger objected to it. It ignores the threat of jihad, it says. Boycott Lowe's here. This is on my website. Or see a brilliant John Stewart on how facts can mess with belief structures, a.k.a. stupid bigotry.
I thought it was canceled, but I can't find anything.
I don't think
it
was canceled. Because don't you think there's a lot of people? I mean, it doesn't seem like a very interesting show to me.
Well, it had huge ratings.
Well, I know.
Yeah.
I mean, particularly now. And here's some people that that want to talk about it. Here's Scott. Scott, hi, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Auburn Hills.
Oh, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you, Peter?
We're good. Great. We're good. What's up?
I am for the show, not as in effect of being super interested in it, but in the fact that if they're getting canceled, after everything else that's on TV, you know, people have a choice to change the channel during that half an hour on that channel.
There's a lot of channels.
Unless they have a wife like mine and makes you sit through six seasons of the Duggar family. You know, but
the ones with all those babies.
Horrible. Yeah,
I mean, if they want to show the way I get it is they want to show their religion from their perspective, and you know, they're an American Muslim,
right?
And this right winger on TV, and I think I just caught like a small glimpse of it, and it might have been somebody making fun of it, but he said that he didn't want it on the air because it wasn't showing the real Muslims.
Yeah, that's right. The real Muslims to him.
The jihad terrorists, and they showed a picture of a crazy terrorist, you know. And I looked at that, and I just shook my head, and it's horrible because every other religion, whether you're Mormon, polygamy, whatever, they have their own show.
Sure.
Yes. You know? Yes.
And it's sickening. It really is. And I hope that the show does get aired. Just to sort of stick it to them and give it.
I hear you, Scott. All right, Scott, thank you very much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mike in Newport. He's got some ideas about this as well. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think it's pretty funny that they think that the reason that they're protesting is that there's not enough, jihadists in it, and they don't show and all this other stuff. I wonder if most of the people in the country thought that the right wingers were all psycho crazy. You know what? How they feel? You know, if we cancel their show or boycott them or something.
Well, but like Fox News. I'd love to see that whole kit and caboodle canceled.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll tell you though, I'm not. Sometimes people there have been campaigns to try to get different talk show hosts to get their advertisers to leave. And I actually, being in this same position on the other side, I'm not real fond of that. That's for sure. I mean, the reason that, or the way, in other words, that what should be done is a boycott should be of listeners or viewers. I mean, that's what really ends it. All right. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your comments. Something drifted through my brain, but I can't.
But it went right back out?
It'll come back. Yeah. Here's Mike also. I can't get what city. Millage Plank? Mike?
Wow. Dead silence.
That is weird. And this says Millage Plank.
Okay. Wait, there you
Mike.
Are.
Mike, are Mike. You with us?
No.
Yes, hello.
Oh, hello.
Mike, where are you calling
you're
from?
You're on the air.
Yeah, you you got the wrong name. It's Frank.
Frank. Frank. Where are you?
In Detroit.
Well, you know, this says Mike Millage Plank. What the hell?
What's Millage Plank?
I have no idea.
Call screener needs to get a hearing aid.
Okay. Well, okay.
Oh, no, we have the best call screeners
ever.
They
are the greatest.
Okay.
Maybe you need to speak clearer. I'm going to support my phone screener.
Go ahead. Let's move beyond this.
I got
this.
A day in English and speech. Okay. anyway, I'm calling about, Peter, I want to get your feedback on the Solyndra scandal.
I don't know. Is it a scandal? I mean, well, it seems like it was mishandled. I mean, this is not infrequent where government stimulus. can we mention the banks? Government attempts to create something, or in case of the banks, correct something. But you know, they were. This looks like a bureaucratic blundering. I don't know if it's a scandal. I mean, I don't care. Call it a scandal. I mean, let me put it this way. What do you think, Frank?
Well, Peter, to me, it looks like it was, another, in your words, bureaucratic bungle.
Yeah.
They messed up. Again, there's 500 and, you know, some. Million. Now, over half a billion dollars.
Yeah, you know, we should tell people this was a startup alternative energy company that the government said, hey, if we lavish all this money on it, it will create jobs, it'll create an alternative to oil, and it just went down the drain, right? So, so when we're talking $500 million of our tax dollars, there should be concern. You know, I have to say that I don't know that much about it. I mean, I thought this is terrible. If the Republicans who are having hearings on it in the House, if they are sincerely doing so in order to see how do we regulate the government intervention in a positive manner into the economy, that's one thing. They're just trying to make political points,
Well, the everything that I've read into it and research I did, shows, Mr. Obama was very much behind this company.
Yeah, and, he was.
After they got the loan, boom, you know, the money's gone. There's people running and hiding. And, you know, it makes you wonder, you know, the honesty of our government officials.
Frank, I keep seeing Mike up here. Frank, you are so cynical, I can't believe it. All right, no, that's something we should keep our eye on. And see, what happened, you know, here's the problem, and I realized that as I was answering you, that it was happening to me as well, that there's suspicion that that issues like this become totally politicized as opposed to making learning some lessons from this and figuring out how to do this better, make sure this never happens again. And if there's anything corrupt or dishonest, that those people pay the price. All right, thanks, Frank. Appreciate that. Hey, in that regard, in fact, I forgot about this. My guest, Gar Alperovitz, who's written this book called America Beyond Capitalism. You go, oh, what's that?
Yeah.
Sounds like a bunch of commies. Well,
mean?
I don't even know.
What do you mean, anarchism?
Yes, but here, in a 2000 Rasmussen poll reported that Americans under 30 were essentially evenly divided as to whether they preferred capitalism or socialism.
I love that.
And 7% of the American population as a whole give the Congress of the United States a good mark, where 10% of the American people support communism. So more people support communism than they do the Congress.
God.
What does that tell us?
Yeah, a lot.
What? I don't know.
There's no faith.
Yeah, and I don't know what people these days even mean by socialism, because if you really think of the word, not so much as people of an older generation, mm-hmm. as socialism connected with authoritarian communism or authoritarian socialism, it's not very good. But when costs are socialized, that is ones that that individuals or individual communities can't put forth themselves, well, then the cost is socialized, like we always say, the police, the fire, right?
Yeah,
roads.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, you want, so.
Things we need.
So that kind of socialism with socialized medicine, so people don't go without, this being the only industrial country in the world, wealthiest country in the world, and we don't have a national health program. It's incredible.
Yeah, sure is.
All right, here's Tristan from Dearborn. Tristan, home of All-American Muslim.
Peter and Jalene, how y'all doing tonight?
Good, Tristan. Good. Thanks for being so patient.
Not a problem. Real quick, I want to touch on one point. Have you guys heard of the death of Kim Jong-il?
Yes, the dictator of North Korea.
Been sick for a while.
You guys beat me to it for once.
Oh, well, actually, I said it in the first 15 minutes of the show.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sorry, but thank you for bringing it up again.
I don't know that this will mean anything, although sometimes, you know, this can begin to shake a society. Is there going to be a Korean winter? You know, wouldn't that be great if they
I don't think so.
Blow those guys out of there?
I just don't see it happening there ever.
I mean, but look at what happened, you know, what was his name? I can't remember his name. The dictator of Romania, Ceausescu? Yeah, it was Ceausescu. He was making a speech from the balcony, like some medieval king or something like that, and all of a sudden people started yelling at him.
Yeah.
And he was stunned because he'd been in power for so long.
Yeah.
And this whole edifice, this whole authoritarian, this whole authoritarian state just crumbled.
Okay, well,
so someone
yelled
at the kid. What's the kid's name? What's the next in the dynasty? The son? You know, I don't.
I actually think his name is also Kim Jong, but I don't think it's Bilbo.
Well, Kim, the family name, of course, is a very, very extraordinarily common name. I mean, in fact, some enormous number of Koreans have the last name of Kim.
Kim, yeah.
Yeah.
There was also two other points I wanted to touch on.
Sure.
You were making the comment earlier about the war crimes in it that have...
Bradley Manning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I look at it this way. If they perpetrated a crime, they should be held responsible and be persecuted for it.
Prosecuted. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it never will happen. As long as power relations are like this, even if you have people. I mean, it is so clear that anybody could make the case. Any prosecutor at the International Criminal Court could make a case against George W. Bush for the international crime of what's called crime against peace. That this was a totally phony constructed war in which they knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. And, but, you know, is he going to be frog marched out of wherever he is now in Texas, you know, in a perp walk like he should be?
No.
Go to get Rumsfeld? Go to get Cheney? You know, Cheney, you know, he was called Darth Vader, and he delights in being called that. That's how evil and dark this man is. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
For sure. All right, Tristan, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in to 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, here is Brad in Windsor. Brad, thanks for making our show international. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
We're good.
Good. So I'm just across the river. I live in Windsor. And one of my things is I enjoy your program very much.
Thank you.
And I listen, and I'm sitting here. You guys are talking about the Muslim program and the Lozad and all that stuff. We have a program here in Canada, which I think is actually a spinoff from your program, Erica. It's called Little Mosque on the Prairie we have.
Little Mosque on the Prairie. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's quite an interesting program, and it's actually unified a lot of Canadians to sit there and say, oh, I get it. I know what all this is about. I understand you people, sort of different things like that. It's kind of actually humorous way of sort of bringing their religion into context. And I sit here and I worry a little bit about you guys. Like I worry about your country and the way your sort of thoughts go and the way you sort of look at different sort of religions and things like that. And you know, I don't know what I'm saying, but I just have a little concern for your country and sort of what's going on down there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole Lowe's comment is just one particular aspect of that.
Well, wait a minute, Brad. We're actually to the north of you.
Yeah, but we're worried too.
Most of Canada is to the north. Most
Windsor's to the south of us.
Windsor is to the south of Detroit. Oddly enough, yeah. But no, I appreciate that. And you know, it just came out. There's this. I can't remember who puts this together, but there's this the survey of the world's happiest countries. And Canada's made it up to number 6.
Yay.
Let me tell you, good country.
Yeah.
I'm smiling right now.
We love Canada and we love Canadians.
Number 1 for the third year in a row, Norway came in.
My homeland.
Yeah. Australia is number 3. Sweden, I think, is actually, why don't they have this in order? This would be so much easier. I was surprised. It says the United States is number 10. I mean, there seems to be so much anger in this country. I mean, what other country in the world do you have people routinely going into workplaces, schools, restaurants,
blowing
people away? You know, I had to kill him. He spilled my Pepsi. You know, all
right,
that stuff.
Right.
This seems like if someone said, what's the dominant emotion in this country? I would say anger.
Yep.
And I don't mean to say that there's
people. And fear.
Anger and fear. Yeah. And I don't know how we made it to number 10, so we're not number 1.
Not either.
Let me see. Joining Norway and Australia in the top 10 are their neighbors, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, and New Zealand. Equally small and civilized, Switzerland and the Netherlands are also up there. Rounding out the top 10 is the United States at 10th and Canada at 6th. So I don't know. I mean, a lot of it has to do with per capita income, like Norway's. You have 54,000. I mean, that's... I mean, that's per capita for 4-year-olds.
Yeah, yeah.
Too. All right, Brad, thank you very much. Appreciate your call considerably. And thanks for caring about us.
Oh, yes. Yeah, thanks for caring about us. We need it. We have some open lines, and so you can call 313-298-9743 and join in the conversation.
And how, given when you see everything from the Tea Party to the Occupy movement to the levels of unemployment to the fact that we're in these endless wars, how can this be the 10th happiest country in the world unless the rest of them are really... Yeah.
I'm not buying it.
Yeah, I mean, all of a sudden I'm totally blanking on this country I was just looking at. In Central America, doesn't have an army, and it is Costa Rica.
Costa Rica,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, why isn't that up there? And so we have the wealth, all of us listening, unless you're in Canada or somewhere else on the planet. And hey, I just got an email from Jacob in Finland. Jacob, we thought we'd lost you as a listener.
Hello, Jacob.
Ulu.
Finland.
Yeah. Yeah. We do morning drive.
You know what?
What's
really cool? I'll look it up and show you, Peter. On our Facebook page on Night Call, I can press a particular button and show where people are listening from. We have listeners in Japan. They're all over the place. I'll show it to you.
Well, ZZ Top sings I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide. We're worldwide.
That's right, baby.
That's right.
And
yeah.
So am I, because I've gone viral.
You have.
Yeah, if you Google my name and Bradley Manning, you too can read one of the 8 million articles in every major and not major newspaper in the world that my quote, because I was in D.C. protesting.
Yeah, Private Bradley Manning on trial for giving out U.S. secrets to WikiLeaks. But how can you have the 10th happiest country in the world when the American census shows that squeezed by rising living costs, a record number of Americans, nearly half, have fallen into poverty or are scraping by on earnings that classify them as low income?
Yeah, 1 in 2 persons in this country is living below the poverty level.
So it's the wealthiest country in the world. Half the people in this country are poor or near poor. And you got to remember, like, where do they have, in this article here, roughly $45,000 for a family of four. Below that, you're a low-income household.
Yeah.
So say you make $44,500. Well, you're up in, close to the 50% where the middle class begins, but then it starts, you're going downward. Like this here, not untypical. The struggling Americans include Zenobia Bechtel, 18 years old in Austin, Texas, who earns minimum wage as a part-time pizza delivery driver. Bechtel and her seven-month-old baby were recently evicted from their bedbug-infested apartment after her boyfriend, an electrician, lost the job in a sluggish economy. After an 18-month job search, Bechtel's boyfriend now works as a waiter, and the family of three is temporarily living with her mother. Bechtel said, who's a high school graduate, wants to go to college. We're paying my mom $200 a month for rent. Hey, Mom. But anyway.
Yeah.
And after diapers and formula and gas for a week, we barely have enough money to spend. If it weren't for food stamps and other government money for families who need help, we wouldn't have been able to survive. And these cold-hearted son of a bitch Republicans want to cut this off. And this has happened in a number of areas.
I don't know how they live with this.
States in the South and the West, which have the highest shares of low-income families, including Arizona, New Mexico, and South Carolina, have scaled back or eliminated aid programs for the needy. You know, there's this film. I don't know if it's still available. It's called Eat the Rich. You know, we play the song by Crocus, and there's another song by Aerosmith, Eat the Rich. But there's a movie called Eat the Rich.
Yeah.
And they have this, and it's about this restaurant called Bastards, where they serve only endangered species.
Oh, my God. I need to see that.
Yeah, and you hear, like, what they, this sort of this ambient sound, and you hear this one guy, so these two little wretches came up to my door, and they said, please, sir, help us. We have nothing. And I said, of course you have nothing. I have everything.
Oh, man.
And that's what's going on here.
Yeah, it sure is.
And that's why, as I said earlier, that poll said that 50% of people under 30 who seem to have more of a conscience than people over 30 support socialism. And what's socialism? It means things like food stamps in our case. I mean, socialism, it's a long story. It used to mean something else in the 20th, 19th century. But we're talking now like a safety net. We're talking about
Social programs.
Social program where people could, where when people are in the condition that Bechtel and her boyfriend are. And here, these are people that are really trying. Trying.
Right. And a lot of people are.
And you can buy, a Rolls Royce, 24 karat gold Rolls Royce.
Oh.
That's 1 million pounds. So I think a pound, an English pound, is worth $1.6 or $1.60, something like that. So these people are scuffling just to have a decent
diapers
life.
Diapers and food.
And somebody is saying, I'm going to get this $1.5 million.
Yeah. Beck, give me two.
Who are you to tell them that they can't spend their money?
Yeah.
Well,
right.
Yeah.
And so, these people need to find a job.
Yeah.
You know, when I was at the protest, you know, the whole thing about the right wingers and saying that we're dirty hippies. We need to get a job and take a shower. I want to tell you what we had. Several people rolled down their windows because we were on the base and all of the military housing was right there and all of the military people were coming in and out of that base. And so we got a lot of flip offs and then get a job, you dirty hippies. And
this is military.
Yeah.
Do they realize they're coming back to the United States and they're not going to have a job?
I don't think they're thinking that far ahead.
No, that's not. Salvation Army here in Detroit has issued an urgent plea for help. Now, this is horrible. The fact that people, in order to not starve to death or have a place to sleep, have to depend on the charity of others. But so
in the
why,
richest country in the world.
Yeah. So you know why that Zenobia Bechtel and her boyfriend, who are trying real hard to get by, don't have money? Because in 2007, according to Sylvia Allegretto, a labor columnist, the six Walton family members, they're the ones that own Walmart, on the Forbes 400, had a net worth equal to the bottom 30% of all Americans.
Oh, my gosh. Astounding.
So these six people, which didn't work for it, right? You say, well, they worked for it. It's their money. They just got it inherited.
And if they did something good with it or treated their employees at least halfway decent or allowed their stores to unionize, maybe I'd give them a 1% of credit for something.
Now, but the Waltons are now collectively worth about $93 billion.
Damn.
But now, wait a minute. I hope I can find this real quickly.
My God, Peter, that's insane.
Oh, yeah. Here, Sam Pizzagatti, who I've interviewed before, and you can... I guess go to toomuchonline.org. he puts as the number, he's got the 10 greediest Americans of 2011. Oh, no, this is only number 10. I can't even imagine what the rest of them are like. But Michael T. Duke, Walmart CEO, Duke takes home his millions, $18.7 million in the company's latest fiscal year by squeezing workers. Duke ended premium pay for the hours Walmart workers have to put on on a Sunday, eliminated profit sharing, shared health care benefits, and cut staffing levels so low. Retailing Today reports that customers sometimes can't find shopping carts because the store where they're shopping has no employees available to collect carts from the parking lot.
God.
So in order to make $18.7 million, he has taken this out of the hides of these people that are working their butts off and getting next to nothing in return, and they're making it worse. I mean, this is something like, what is this, the 1880s?
Yeah, it's very, very reminiscent of that.
Have I told you tonight how much I hate these son
people.
Of bitches?
Son of a bitches.
Yeah, it's past 12, we can say it.
Yeah, we can.
It's got a couple calls in. Here is Yaya from Dearborn Heights. Yaya,
hey.
Hi, you're on the air.
How are you guys?
We're good.
Hi.
Hey, just so you know, I'm from Venezuela. My parents are Lebanese, so I'm Muslim.
Oh.
I love my rock and roll music. I go out. My best friend, she's a Jew. We're just normal people, you know what I mean? We're not radical like the group from Florida is trying to say, or Terry Jones. We're just here because we just want to have a normal life. You know what I mean? Look at me. I got tickets for Mastodon, and I was at the concert.
Mastodon. She's a total
and
rocker.
I love my Mayhem concert, and I love to see Metallica, and I'm about to go see Megadeth.
You're just a normal
people.
Rocker.
You sound like a riff rocker to me.
I am.
That's beautiful.
I think it's from Five Finger Death Punch, but anyways, I
didn't win it. Now, see, this is the kind of thing that we need to hear. That people, we appreciate when you call into the show and say this because we know that, but the people out there who just see the word Muslim or hear the word Muslim and they automatically go to a negative place.
Yeah, I mean, my mom, she wears a scarf, and she will not ever fly Air France again because they made her took the scarf out of her head, you know.
Huh.
And then last time, that was when she was flying, you know, to Lebanon for some papers. And then when she was flying back, they would not let her get in the plane. And we're talking about a 75-year-old lady.
You serious?
Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, the whole France scarf thing is a whole issue unto its own.
On the Statue of Liberty, it says that whole thing, give me your tired huddle, masses and what. But this country has never, ever been very welcoming to its immigrants. Right from the beginning, I mean, certainly, you know, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, the Asians, the people from Latin America, and people from the Middle East have always been, talked about badly, said they're not real Americans, they're lazy, they're dangerous, why don't they adopt American habits? You know, this is every immigrant group that's ever come along.
If you're going to live in the United States, you got to learn to speak English.
And so a third, this is this, and so these haters, which go back, 200 years in this country, it's a constant. And they don't represent the majority of people. The majority of people in this country are welcoming and understand that they themselves, if they came from Germany or Russia or China or what have you.
Ireland,
well, at least they spoke the same language, but they know that, that there's a cultural difference.
Well, yeah.
And that begins to lessen over the years. So, a lot of times the people from the old country, they want to maintain a lot of the old ways, and suddenly the kids, they're listening to rock and roll, and they're wearing, kind of non-traditional clothing.
Modernly dressed. Really quick, Yaya, while you're on the phone, Pauline, who's a listener of Night Call, I'm imagining she's listening right now, she quoted Sean Hannity and calling him what a friggin' nutcase. This is his quote about Muslims. You know, I'm a believer that no country has shed more blood in defense of freedom for Muslims around the world. Freedom for Muslims around the world than the United States. Nor has there ever been a country that has accumulated more power and has abused it less than us.
Well,
this guy is delusional.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. I got to go, but I appreciate your call.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, actually, I didn't even say I would do this, but I walked into one of the L.A. fitness places where we play handball, me and the boys.
Yeah.
And this guy said, hey, are you Peter Werby? And I thought,
really?
And I said, yeah. And I said, how'd you know that? He said, I actually probably looked at my key fob and, you know.
And said, do you know your name?
But he said, no, he listens to the show all the time. So it's a shout out to Craig at LA Fitness.
Craig, thank you for listening.
Yeah. And,
did you ask Peter for his autograph?
No, he wasn't. We don't have fans like that. We have co-thinkers.
Yes, we do. You're right. Yeah. I don't think I've ever once been asked for an autograph for this show. For my other DJ stuff, I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what I should do is take a break for our final segment. Theo, the rest of you, stay on the line and we'll get your calls. There are open lines, 313. Well, we pay somebody.
And you know what we do? This is the final segment of the year. So if you have something to say, get it out now.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julene.
All right, thank you very much. This is our final segment for the year. Next Sunday is Christmas. The one after is New Year's Eve. So we are going to be...
Hello. Oh,
what's the matter?
Oh, I thought my mic wasn't on.
No. I haven't done that.
We're not going to be here, but we'll be here after that. And we say on this show, happy holidays, because it's the inclusive and loving thing to do.
What, to say that?
Yeah.
I mean, there's somebody here. I hope he's not listening. That you say, happy holidays. He says, it's Christmas.
Yeah, I know. And all these things, you know, Christmas has been co-opted. My kids can't say it in school. Well, you know, come on, get over it. You celebrate Christmas at home and in the church, right?
Yeah. Well,
school's for school.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is, you know, the right wing's gone a little bonkers on this because, you know, they know they can stir up their base and they get these people frothing. They said, talk about, the war on Christmas. That's their thing.
The war on Christmas. That's what I was trying to think.
So here you got this, you go into a store and rather than saying happy holidays, which to me is just a festive time of the year. There's lots of...
And loving.
What?
It's inclusive and loving to say
And
that.
It includes, to me, New Year's, because, you know, we're at a new beginning, although it's arbitrary. It's just a little date on the calendar. So what these folks want is to say, Merry Christmas. So screw the Jews, screw the Muslims, screw the atheists.
Yes, screw the African-Americans who celebrate
Kwanzaa. The, you know, all of that.
Yeah, I had someone say to me, you know, what is up with all of this? You know, like Kwanzaa. Why do they have to have Kwanzaa? And I thought, first of all, I don't know if I can continue speaking to you.
Yeah.
But I will in the name of educating your ignorant brain. That's all.
No, we're not going to celebrate Kwanzaa. We're going to celebrate Christmas. Oh, okay. Well, that makes
sense. Fine, then. You're okay. Yeah. Carry on.
You know, I didn't put my... let me go to my website here. That's going down kind of fast. And this nice little thing here. Why I am an atheist. And that's a little... let me see. Is this going to come up for me? We go.
Okay.
And there is a religion that was way before, Mithras. I think it's called,
what is this here?
Mithras. I'm not saying.
I don't know what you're talking about.
This is a religion.
Oh, okay.
And, Mithras.
Mithras.
It's Mithras.
Okay.
It was in Persia. And, let's see. Mithras was buried in a tomb from which he rose again from the dead, an event celebrated yearly with much rejoicing. And he was known as Savior, Son of God, Redeemer, the Lamb of God. His followers kept the Sabbath holy, eating sacramental meals in memory of him. Mm-hmm. The sacred meal of bread and water or bread and wine was symbolic of the body and the blood of the sacred bull.
Wait a minute. So what's up with Jesus?
Well, you think this may be... Also, and there's more to Mithra, that there were wise men that came to his virgin birth. This is Mithras.
I where are you getting this? And is this real?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you know what? It really started with the pagans. The tree, that whole thing.
Well, that stuff is all Yeah, they tried to co-opt the pagans.
Yeah, well, they did co-opt the pagans, Peter.
Yeah, I guess they did.
Christmas has been entirely co-opted by the Christians against from the pagans, no question.
Christmas tree, the Yule log.
Yeah.
The whole idea.
The whole thing.
Yeah. All right, here's Theo in Detroit. Hi, Theo, you're on the air.
Happy holidays. Well, you said, get it out, this is the last show, right?
Right.
Yeah, get it out, girl.
I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. Only a hippopotamus will do.
I love that song. Because you know what? Even though I don't celebrate Christmas.
Because earlier you were speaking about the people on welfare and the safety net, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the federal government budget is only 5% that goes to social programs.
See?
And they make
you.
Such a big issue as if it's all of it or something. But right here in this state, there is a representative by the name of Arrington. I believe his first name is Jeff.
Okay.
Who wants to have drug testing for people on welfare. I guess those applying and those on.
Well, it happened in Florida already, didn't it, Peter?
Sure did.
And I want to tell you, this angers me so much. And when people post things like this on the internet, I just think, you know what? I don't think I can talk to you again.
I understand.
Well, you know, Theo, you say to these people, you say, well, you know, the big money is going down the drain of the military-industrial complex. It's all of these companies, these corporations that are paying no federal income tax whatsoever, in some cases even getting money back on things. And you're worried about whether somebody in a housing project is maybe spending a little of their supplement to buy some weed or something like that. I mean, they just have this misplaced sense of where the big ripoffs are coming from.
And I agree. Now,
and it's all about looking down their noses at poor people.
I think they should start with the elected officials. If you want to drug test somebody, let's start with them.
Uh-oh.
Now, here
we drug test nobody?
There has been talk about laying off 1,000 workers. This is from the mayor. And then the pro tem council president wants 2,300. Well, now, let us drug test the council and the mayor. But in the meantime,
this is in Detroit,
if they want to drug test the employees, they may have legitimate reasons for laying off and or firing some of them rather than the union method, which is the last hired are the first ones to be laid off.
Uh-huh.
Who are probably happy they have a job and can take care of their families. So if they want to use the drug testing piece, let's start there. Don't you think the elected officials need to?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if fair is fair, right?
Yes, absolutely. Theo, thank you.
Theo,
you have some happy holidays. Thanks for joining us. Speaking of drugs, this is a real war on drugs. You know, usually we joke and say, wow, war on drugs. I can't even drive on drugs. But the damage.
Which we don't.
Yes.
And we don't do drugs. Yeah, the only drug we do is the liquid.
The drug of despair.
Alcohol.
Yeah, right. No, I love to drink.
Yeah.
What did I just say?
But you don't drink to excess.
No, never, never. But anyway, I don't. Actually.
No, you really don't.
But the U.S. war on drugs has wasted $1 trillion, created the prison industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, another way that our treasury is being robbed. But, here's a country that really is doing an actual war on drugs. Iran has executed more people for drug-related crimes in 2011 than in the previous 2 years combined, according to Amnesty International, calling the killing spree of staggering proportions. Iran put 488 people to death in 2011 for drug offenses.
Oh, my God. What I want to know about that is, what kind of drugs are they doing in Iran?
Hashish. I don't know. Who knows? Well, they're near near a big center of heroin. Well, you know, through poppies and what have you.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Yeah,
and those are growing.
Here is what the poppies are growing.
Yeah, they're back. Yeah.
Here's Aaron in Novi. Aaron, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, it's good to be on. I just started listening a couple weeks ago, but so far I've been enjoying everything I hear.
Well, thank you.
Well, I wanted to make a comment on the Happy Holidays, Merry Christmas thing. I'm atheist, agnostic myself, but my wife's a Christian. She's non-denominational, and she had two really good points. She was talking to, she's telling me a story, talking to people at work, and it's like, she celebrates Christmas. It's Santa.
you know, Santa bringing presents. It's like being with the family, you know, eating dinner.
Yeah.
It's like, first of all, Jesus was not born, you know, this time of year. It, you know, doesn't say that anywhere in the Bible. Secondly, it doesn't say anywhere in the Bible to celebrate Jesus' birth.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, you know.
So how do you deal with peace in the family over that issue?
It works out pretty well. I mean, my issue I've always told her is with faith in general. It's like, I don't understand how you can have, you know, faith. It's like, you only believe in this because you've learned it from other people who believe in it, from learning it from other people who believed in it. Like, if you're just taking what people are saying, then you'd have to take it from all angles and hear everybody's side of the story. But it's really just saying, ours is the truth, ours is the truth, ours is the truth.
And yours isn't.
No.
Yeah. And that's dangerous because you just think about all the religious wars that are still going on. I mean, think about.
And will always.
Well, and I mean, we think, oh, look at those Muslims, the Shiites fighting
Sunnis.
Oh, how uncivilized. Yeah. Did the Catholics ever fight the Protestants?
Oh, yes, they did.
A few times. Yeah.
And I want to. Can I tell you something? Who's our caller?
Aaron.
Aaron. That's a toughie. Being an atheist and being with a Christian, I want to tell you firsthand. And here's the thing with my atheism is when in the last two relationships I've been into, somewhat long-term relationships, something about my atheism drove these people crazy. Because when I met them, they were not very religious at all. But all of a sudden, started wanting to be more Christian and wanting I pushed them over the edge with it, you know. So I really think that I've got to find someone, from the person it's a requirement that you have to be an atheist.
Well, there's,
I'm narrowing my field a lot.
Yeah.
And you also have to be a total lefty.
Well, you can go to the Freedom From Religion Foundation's annual, convention.
I'll go and learn some things and go shopping.
Well, I wouldn't limit yourself to just atheism either, because there's some other.
Well, you can be a pagan. You can be a pagan.
Buddhism.
You can be a Buddhist.
Good ideas in there.
Yeah, I'm cool with that.
I don't agree with the mysticism part of that at all, but generally, if you read what Buddha said, I think that it's a lot of it's misunderstood and put in, you know, into a mysticism just because people want to see things like that.
Yeah.
But basically, just what he says about, like, reality and how everything is just the way it is. And
yeah. I've practiced, like, Buddhism on a kind of ongoing level of chanting and meditating and things like that. Done a lot of reading about it. So I'm down with that, too. So, yeah, you can be a Buddhist.
Happy holidays, Aaron. Happy holidays to you and your wife. You have a
Don't talk about religion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be kind to each other.
Well, my father, who became a Christian late in life after living all of his life with our whole atheist family.
Yeah.
But yet, when he was passing away, I never heard a mention.
About God?
About God or Jesus or the Bible or anything like that.
Do you think he just did it because his wife?
His new wife?
Yeah.
No. That's what he claimed.
Oh. And she said no?
She said, I hadn't been to church in 25 years till your dad started taking it.
He was blaming her for it.
He was throwing her under the bus.
He's a rebel just like you. He was.
That's not very rebellious.
Oh, well, okay, you're right.
Where else? There's a couple of other things here that, what is this going to, you know what? So it gets, you know what?
What? What?
I'm just debating whether to be really serious here.
Well, you know what? It's the last 15 minutes of the show. Go for it.
Okay.
We're a serious show. We laugh and joke.
This is kind of frightening. Chinese President Hu, isn't that part of, never mind. President Hu Jintao.
That's not serious.
Yeah. On Tuesday, urged the Chinese Navy, to prepare for military combat amid growing regional tensions over maritime disputes and a U.S. campaign to assert itself as a Pacific power. Now, what in the hell is Obama doing?
Stirring up that hornet's nest.
Yeah, you figure, where is the military going to go next? They got, well, you know, we're not in Iraq anymore, at least mostly out of there. Still.
Yeah, what are we going to do with all these employees?
Let's send them to Australia. Because
all this equipment.
Yeah, yeah. Now, here is something. Get this. This is from David Swanson's website. It's called warisacrime.org. And here he's talking about, this was on December 7th, the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, 1941.
We really didn't talk about that much this year.
He says, when President Franklin Roosevelt visited Pearl Harbor on July 28, 1934, so this is over 7 years before, it says 7 years before the Japanese attack, the Japanese military expressed apprehension. General Kushiga Tanaka wrote in the Japanese Advertiser, objecting to the buildup of the American fleet and the creation of additional bases in Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. He said, such insolent behavior makes us most suspicious. It makes us think a major disturbance is purposely being encouraged in the Pacific. This is greatly regretted.
Yeah.
Now, the Japanese were these terrible imperialists, and what they essentially wanted was control of these Pacific Rim countries.
Mm-hmm.
And were they wanted to extend their empire. They wanted to drive out all the Western powers that had colonized China and Burma and Indochina and India and what have you, and they wanted to bring it under their control. But when you start messing around in other people's backyard, it is the entrance hall to war. And we don't want to do that with China. I mean, for one thing, why in the world are we involved in military military base, stationing our military troops in Australia?
Yeah.
Bring them home.
Yeah, bring them home, all of them.
Yeah. So that's the bad news. The other thing is, and this is, you know, they're talking about now about banning all cell phone use in cars, even like the system I have through Ford, the Sync, S-Y-N-C system.
You've called me on that a few times.
It's hands-free. Yeah. But, you know, it's still, you have to say...
you're still distracted.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, the argument against it is, of course, people say, well, what about listening to the radio?
That's true.
I don't
talk radio?
But you know what? You're not as engaged in it when you're listening.
Yeah, that's true.
As opposed to... So they want you... Let me see if this is... Pardon me. It says, who is this? Deborah Hersman, chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. I mean, this is a big deal, important group.
Sure, sure.
So the new tech also echoes a growing consensus among scientists that using phones and computers can be compulsive, both emotionally and physically, which helps to explain why drivers may have trouble turning off their devices, even if they want to. And, you know, I have to tell you that I have so many email accounts for work and other projects. Yeah. I have my personal one, the magazine I work on and all that, that I actually have to sometimes force myself to not go and say, well, I wonder if anybody has written about this. I mean, something that I could wait a few hours to see whether they responded.
Sure.
I'm going to go back in 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, these computers have us addicted.
Well, they're talking a running joke about Blackberries as crackberries.
Oh, well, yeah, that's been for a long time.
Yeah, she said, this is more serious than people think. Ms. Hersman said, addiction to these devices is a very good way to think about it. It's not unlike smoking. We have to get to a place where it's not in vogue anymore, where people recognize it's harmful and there's a risk and it's not worth it. I mean, I routinely, well, I mean, everybody sees this. There's people driving down the road with a cell phone. And
yeah, it's very rare that I talk on the cell phone in my car. I'm easily distracted. You know, we call this ADD radio, and that goes through the other parts of my life, and that I just know it's not a good idea.
The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that at any given moment last year, 660,000 drivers were holding phones to their ears.
My God. And did you see that? There was a huge accident in Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
Texting. In fact,
The guy was texting. He had gotten... Let me see, a 19-year-old driver, and he had gotten something like 11 texts. And they say that as more and more, that there's more things available on the, you know, like your iPhones.
Like and apps and all of that, you mean?
Yeah, that there's so many things that you can do.
And I don't have one of those either, on purpose.
What?
I don't have internet on my phone.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, let's see, at any given moment last year on America's streets and highways, nearly one in every 100 drivers, that's 10%, were texting, emailing, surfing the web, or otherwise using a handheld electronic device, according to the Safety Administration. Mm. And
I
think if you told people now that you would have to, this was no longer allowable. I mean, for one thing, I wonder if they could tell, since I have that Sync system.
Or if you're just talking to yourself?
They could say, yeah. I always wonder. Sometimes I'm walking, I don't use it that much because I have a cell phone, which I do not even know the phone number off by memory.
I don't know it either. I just
Don't you have it in your phone? You're one of the few people that have it.
I know.
You, my wife. Anybody else?
I think that's probably about it.
Yeah.
It's top secret information.
Well, it's not even that. I rarely carry it with me. I don't have it with me now.
You kind of call me a lot on it, though.
I do?
Yeah.
I don't a lot.
Are you? You texted me, too.
I texted you once.
I'm outing you.
But I texted on my wife's iPhone.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
I can't believe she has an iPhone.
I don't know.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, I go to little gatherings of friends now, and everybody's got their little iPhone out.
Oh, yeah.
And
you know what it is? If one person, when I was hanging out with our buddy in D.C., he's on all of that because he tours the world, so he uses it a lot, all the apps and everything like that. So he would pull it out, the phone, and then I would pull my phone out. One person does it, the other one does it. And he mentioned that. He goes, isn't it amazing how if one person just picks up that phone and starts texting, the other one automatically gets theirs? Well, I better check mine, too. It's a sickness.
Well, you know that increasingly there's things. Well, they have the new, what is it, the G4 or something?
I don't keep track.
But you have voice questions like, where's a good Italian restaurant around me? And and the phone knows where you are.
Yeah.
You don't have to say I'm
GPS.
At One Radio Plaza.
Yeah.
Right. And so people, I was at a little gathering on Friday of friends, and I was in the other room talking with a couple of guys about something. But then everybody in the other room, they were saying things like, are you dressed? And so the woman's voice is, on the phone, is answering back. This is a robot saying, why does everyone ask me that?
Oh, wow. Weird.
Yeah. And so they were asking, like, purposely misleading questions.
Oh, okay.
And trying to see what kind of answers they get back. And I'm thinking, wow, what did people used to do before these little gadgets?
Wow, we really could find other things to do. Which, I don't – do you make resolutions for New Year's since it's our last show of the year?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Always?
Yeah.
Why?
What? Why?
You really do? And do you follow through with them?
No.
Okay, me neither.
In fact, I can't even tell you on the air what they are.
Oh. Well, one of mine is to, and this goes along with the whole technology thing, is to turn the television off and read more.
You know, I don't watch that much television, but I am just spending too much time in front of the computer.
So maybe you need to join me in
well,
but you do so much in...
You know, I'm never... chatting. I don't chat either. Yeah, I mean, so
but I'm on that damn Facebook.
I am working. I don't do Facebook. The reason I don't do Facebook is because
I do it for you.
I don't want to give away more time. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, you've got me.
It's work. I mean, I just finished doing the design. In other words, the layout of a 48-page magazine.
Right. Yeah.
And so I wound up doing a lot of it myself. So I'm dealing with it. So I turned out to be the editor and publisher and designer.
And you're right.
Yeah, so
you take photos.
And I'm editing. Yeah, I actually had some of my photos. And so I'm editing stuff, and then, you send back, all right, here's what we're using. You took out, the name of the person and put in a pronoun here. I'm going, I can't believe this.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe try to get away from that a little bit,
But it's over. So I'm going to do nothing for the next couple of weeks. Not going to do Night Call because next week is Christmas.
New Year's?
Yeah.
We'll be ready to go because, in 1 week, it's amazing how much information we gather for this show.
So it'll be
three weeks. It's going to be off the hook.
Well, hey. Thanks to all of you. Jillian Jordan, thank you.
Thank you. Another great year with you, Peter.
And now, of course, to Sarah and Athena.
Yes. We're thankful for you this holiday season.
We are. Thank you to all the people here at WRI. Thank you to the management for being so tolerant of a couple of nuts.
Yeah, a couple of crazy lefties. But we want to thank WRIF for keeping this show on the air for 40, almost 1 years.
Yeah.
And I'm, for one, I'm very proud to be a part of it.
All right.
Thanks for bringing me on, Peter.
So happy holidays. And we'll see you next year.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Pleasure to have you listening to this broadcast. I think it's a real important one because we're not just talking about what's wrong, as we do so frequently on this broadcast, but how we can move ahead. Can you imagine even 4 or 5 months ago, 6 months ago, people parading in our city saying capitalism sucks? Or capitalism doesn't work, or that we're being ruled by this greedy elite, that the banksters have made a sham of both the economy and of our democracy. And now, because of the Occupy movement, like them or not, it's on most people's lips, examining what our country's about. Why do we live in the richest country in the world? And study just out saying half the people in this country are either poor or near poor. Something is wrong here. And how do we address it? People have tried to address the inequities of capitalism ever since it began. And we've come up with some bad authoritarian, totalitarian answers called communism. So we're not very fond of that. What do we do beyond that? Well, this is a key word, beyond. Gar Alperovitz. Now, we were just talking. Let me introduce the man first. Gar Alperovitz is my guest, and he was telling me a shorter way to say his name, and I've been saying for years the longer version of it. Gar Alperovitz, right?
That's right.
Welcome, because the reason that I know, and the reason I know the longer version of Gar's name, is that his book, The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb, is something I've used on my shows regularly every August 6th to talk about that fateful decision. But Gar was telling me that a much shorter way is to just say Gar Alperovitz. And he's written a book called America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And Gar Alperovitz is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. He's written numerous books, and he's the co-founder of Democracy Collaborative. This is all playing into what we're going to be talking about. America Beyond Capitalism. We seems like a system that we're kind of stuck with, yet you're saying that we may be able to move beyond that. How do we do that without getting into the negatives that none of us want to share in?
Well, the simple way to think about it, I think, is that there are many, many institutions in the United States today that they don't look like capitalism, they certainly don't look like communism, but what they really do is they share ownership in a democratic way. Democratizing ownership might be the way to think about it. So think about co-ops.
Sure.
The traditional American co-op is a model that, when you include all the credit unions, which are co-ops, 140 million people in the United States, it's about 40% of the population, are already members of credit unions or co-ops or agricultural co-ops or consumer co-ops. So what you have there is not capitalist or private corporations owning capital and not the big state communist bureaucracies, but it's a very common democratic form that gives people the ownership of wealth, the productive wealth, in a way that is much more egalitarian and much more democratic. And it turns out they're much more efficient also. Not surprisingly, when people have a share in ownership, they tend to work more for their own sense of what they own and they're part of. So that's one way to think about an America beyond capitalism. And we've discovered many, many other ways of doing this that are already existing that could be built upon. One state does something for Alaska, for instance, state where you think it's very conservative, but all the oil revenues in Alaska, half of them go to finance the public services, and another chunk of them go as public in a democratized way. They give out money to all the citizens as a matter of right because the citizens own the oil resources. So at the last couple of years ago, when you have, if you have a family of a man and a woman and three kids, that's five individuals, and they got about $10,000 in as a matter of legal right because the community says that's our oil and we're going to democratically allocate it. So when you actually look below, you know, the press doesn't have time or money in most cases to study this. The country's filled with this sort of thing that's up in North Dakota, not too far from where you all There's a state bank that's been operating. It's a public bank, and it doesn't speculate the way the Wall Street ones do, but it helps finance farms and homes and co-ops and businesses, small businesses. So what you can build up is a mosaic of many, many, many institutions that, if you build on them, point towards a vision that is really very American, and it's not corporate capitalism, and it's not bankster capitalism, if you use that term, and it's not the communist Russian system, but it is a system where the ownership of wealth is democratized, benefits all the people instead of the 1%. By the way, latest statistic on this, I mean, it's kind of shocking when I looked at it. 1% of the population, just the top 1%, owns just about half of all the productive wealth in the country today. I mean, 1% of the population. That idea about 99% is a good one, because the 1% now not only gets a lot of income, but it gets a huge amount of the productive, of the factories, the farms, the businesses, the stores. 1% owns just about a little under half of that. And an America beyond capitalism of the kind I'm talking about, and I write about in the book with the same name, obviously, America Beyond Capitalism, is a way of looking at things on the ground today in America that begin to point towards a very different and a very American vision of how we might do this.
Gar Alperovitz is my guest, and he is the author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. The fear that I have, because certainly this idea of cooperative, the whole cooperative movement, we can talk about some of how it's functions like in Spain and the United Steelworkers, who are very much into this idea, how they, you know, how they play in all of this. But the economy is still going to be dominated as it stands now, unless things change dramatically. They are essentially they have command of the economy, both in the financial sector and in the productive sector. Are we going to be able to do anything with co-ops and small businesses and locavars and what have you, will just be anything other than just sort of us scrambling around on the margins?
Well, it all depends. And let me put it in one way to think about it. If you look at what happened in the New Deal, many of the programs of the New Deal were developed in the 10 and 20 years before that in smaller experiments at the state level and the local level that began to build up knowledge, technique, and learning how to do it. And when the right moment came politically, they began to give principles of what you might do at the national level. So that's one way to think about it. Another is, you know, we think about manufacturing as the kind of stereotype, particularly in Detroit, where I've recently been in Detroit. My wife's from Detroit, so I'm there a lot. You know, manufacturing only has about 9% of the working population working, even in full production. We're no longer heavily manufacturing. So many of the things that, quote, have to be big, big corporations, that's changing radically now. So that's another way to look at it. And a third is, you know, the pain levels are growing. People are really unhappy, and rightly so. And we saw how easily when things went wrong, boom, GM and Chrysler were nationalized. And I suspect some of the big oil companies might go. And certainly when the next financial crisis goes, we may, you know, those five big banks that have kind of destroyed local banking in many areas, the number of local banks that have been gobbled up is enormous. And those banks, when the next crisis comes, they may break them up, but ultimately I think some of them are going to become public banks. So we'll see where this all goes over time. But I think the fundamental is to how do we learn in a better way through our own practical experience at the local level, and as far local as you can go, what the principles of a really democratic management of co-ops and worker-owned companies and larger companies might actually be from experimenting and developing on the basis of this experience.
Gar Alperovitz is my guest. He's written America Beyond Capitalism, and he has actually in today's New York Times, the day we're recording this, has a an op-ed piece called Worker Owners of America Unite, and this is a lot of what we're talking about. Two things jumped out at me. I'll just mention one of them, and Gar, you just mentioned it yourself. One line begins, when the next financial breakdown occurs. So this is writing. In other words, the cyclical nature of capitalism, as we've always experienced since its origins in this country, you don't think there's any break we have against something similar coming again?
I think there's two parts of it. If you look at the banking system, I don't know one serious, knowledgeable expert, left, right, or center, in their political views, who believes we won't have another big financial crisis. Everybody knows that the banks are getting around all the regulations that were passed because they've got lobbyists in there working. Last time I saw, there were 3,000 of them up trying to get those regulations loosened up in a way that they can do what they want to do and continue doing what they want to do, which is going to get them in trouble. And most we will have, it's almost certain we will have another financial crisis. And then what do you do? I mean, regulating these big monsters, really hard to do because they're so powerful and lobbyists. So people think the next thing will happen, they'll break them up, which may happen ultimately. But what history shows is they often get back together like AT&T did and Standard Oil did. And I think the end of that line is really the only alternative is going to make some of them into a public utility. But that's on the financial side. On the economic recession, depression side, again, I think we're in for long-term decay. I don't think we're going to have a big collapse like the Great Depression, but which when where you got 25 to 30% unemployment. But I do think we will have regular periods of 15% unemployment and not many periods of high growth, because I think we don't have an economic problem. Let me put it this way. We have a political problem in managing the economy properly. This is the richest economy in the history of the world. It ought to be managed properly, and we wouldn't have these difficulties. But the politics of it just doesn't work. We get into these crazy things in Washington, and it's sort of built in because there's so many interest groups at work who have special interests that are contrary to an intelligent management of the economy. I often, just to give a kind of simple way of thinking about it, when I said that people kind of sometimes in talks say we don't have an economic problem, we have a political problem. This economy, even today, is producing just a little bit under $200,000 for every family of four. It's a very rich economy. And, you know, in the Great Depression, I had an aunt, I'm from Wisconsin, I had an aunt who put it this way. She said, you know, there wasn't much money around during the Depression. Really, nobody's getting any jobs. And all of a sudden, World War II came, and boy, there was a lot of money and a lot of jobs. Now, what that tells you is, you can run an economy in wartime at full employment, full jobs, there is a way to solve the problem. It's not economic. It's politically managing the economy in an intelligent way.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Gar Elprovitz, he's written America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And it's published, well, tell me about the publishing effort, because you are part of a co-founder of Collaborative Wealth, and the website is community-wealth.com. Also, we can go to AmericaBeyondCapitalism.com, but tell us a little, I'm sorry, it's Democracy Collaborative. Tell us a little about that and, you know, the publishing effort as well.
Sure. Well, we set up, I'm at the University of Maryland, and we set up within, as one of the, you know, sort of kind of parts of the university, it's like a center at the university. It's called the Democracy Collaborative, and it really does two things. One, it does, or maybe three. One, the kind of theoretical research about what is a vision of where we could go in a very different way that democratizes ownership. And my book, America Beyond Capitalism, is one piece of that, and that's one side of it. We also we do publish research on very specific things. For instance, in just not far away in Cleveland, some of the hospitals have decided to buy from worker co-ops in their area in order to stabilize the community, and we help them with that. And it's very interesting because these hospitals, and the same thing in Detroit, they in a small little neighborhood, they buy $3 billion of goods and services, hospitals and universities, mm-hmm. Most of it not from the community, some of it from hundreds of miles away. And there was a decision made to try to buy more of that, not only locally, but if you're going to focus it and you're going to point it to help build the community, why make one person rich because of that? So they've set up a complex, and we helped with this, of worker and community cooperatives linked together with a nonprofit corporation that's trying to help the community build up its economy. And buying from them directly is a specific way of kind of both helping build the structure and build a stable structure. Worker-owned co-ops don't get up and run away in the next tax break from some other town. They stay in the community. So we help with that kind of research and on-the-ground work. I think that sort of thing obviously could be done in Detroit. If it's being done in several other cities, Atlanta and Pittsburgh and Oakland, and even the city of in Texas is looking into doing this. And certainly in the Maryland area as well. We're just getting a lot of folks who are trying to do this Cleveland model. And the third thing we do is hands-on kind of helping with the on-the-ground development with it. And the book, we decided to put, my book originally came out at the height of the economic boom about 6 years ago. And a book called America Beyond Capitalism, by the way, which is mostly practical examples plus a vision of how to democratize, you know, what would real democracy be if you built up from that. That wasn't a very good title at a moment of very high economic boom. But recently, we had decided, as the deep recession continued, really it's time to see if folks are really more open to it now, and we'll put out a new edition. And what better way, since we believe in some sort of nonprofit or democratic development, and since we wanted to move very, very, very fast, and most publishers are terribly slow, 9 months, usually like a baby, you put the book in 9 months later,
yeah,
you get it. We decided the best way to do that, given the modern electronic technology, is to do it ourselves, and you can turn it around in 2 weeks rather than 9 months, and partly because all the profits then go to a nonprofit corporation to help further research and the work we're doing. So that's happening, by the way, in a lot of areas. People are saying, why bother with the big publishers? They really don't give you much, and they're so delayed and bureaucratic. We could do it locally with the new electronic technology.
Sure. Gar Elfrovitz, you were recently in Detroit at a conference, and I wonder if that speaks dramatically to what we're talking about here. And it has some interesting concepts about, we're talking about jobs coming back, and people I know, like the author Grace Boggs, Detroit activist, who has written the Next American Revolution, who I interviewed just a little while ago. There was talk about jobs aren't coming back. What we got to talk about is work. And I wonder if that fits in with your concepts.
I think it's both and rather than either or. And first let me say Grace Lee Boggs is a treasure, a national treasure, and a wonderful woman, just a stellar person and a treasure for Detroit to have. I was out speaking at her request at a conference, as you mentioned, about 2 months ago, I guess, maybe three. And I think where Grace has been really involved also in the urban agriculture and using it, which is really the interesting thing, using it as a way to develop people and young people and give them new skills and new sense of hope. And I think that's very important work they're doing. I don't think that's the only way to go forward. I think we still have lots to do in a big national economy. Jobs can come back. They should come back. We ought to be in the richest economy in the world. We ought to be managing things better. They don't have to disappear if we were doing intelligent economic policy. But I think that means changing the institutions, the giant corporations and the big bankers. Remember, I guess I should mention, I worked in both the House and Senate and in the executive branch. I was a legislative director for Senator Nelson of Wisconsin, the founder of Earth Day, and with a group of 135 congressmen at a different point. What you actually find out is that the lobbyists and the big bankers are so powerful that intelligent economic policy that could really produce the jobs, as I say, you can do it when you want to in a war, you certainly could do it in peacetime, just is not possible right now. We're going to have to change the way the economy, the institutions, and I'm a long-term historian. I think building up step by step, real things that people participate in and own, the kind that I was talking about here in the co-ops and the 140,000 people, and there are 13 million people involved in worker-owned companies, which I didn't mention. There's many other things like this around the country. There are 4,000 or 5,000 neighborhood corporations. There are many credit unions that are part of this co-op development. We could go on going into it, and even in red states like Alabama, where the state government does investments of public funds for local purposes. There are a lot of models to build on. But I think changing what happens locally so we have a really democratic base for the economy and for the institutions, that's the key to long-term economic functioning at the national level, because, those kinds of institutions really have the priorities of the community at stake. How do we do it here? What will help us? Rather than some of these companies that, they want to go off and get cheap labor abroad and bring back the profits or not bring back the profits. They really have no linkage to communities.
Sure.
And building up the community base, I think, is ultimately the key also to politics, because if we can build a politics from the bottom up that has different priorities, then we have some chance of getting at these other companies and lobbyists that are really dominating things in Washington now.
Well, it's important that you've written the book, America Beyond Capitalism, because I'm looking at the clock. We have about 5 minutes more and probably about 2 hours of conversation. That's why Gar Elperovitz wrote America Beyond Capitalism. I mentioned at the outset of this program about the United Steelworkers and how they're transforming and this huge co-op in Spain, Mondragon. I wonder if you could just briefly tell us that, and does that have possibilities here?
Yes, the Spanish, it's in the Basque Country, and it's about 50 years old, 100,000 people or so working in a co-op in high-tech. Again, we're not talking about just your corner co-op. There they've got advanced research, medical production, electronic production. The ratio of top-to-bottom salaries is 5-to-1 in most of them, and just in a few of them it's 9-to-1 and no more. Here the CEO ratio is 2-to-300-to-1 from the top to the bottom. Well, that model has a lot to teach us, and the U.S. Steelworkers Union, I worked also with in Ohio when 30 years ago in the shutdowns, the U.S. Steelworkers and all the unions were against workers owning. They believed in the old union model. But here again, you see this pattern of evolution. Now the U.S. Steelworkers have changed. They're now advocating worker ownership along the Mondragon model and in many other forms. And I think that evolutionary process at the neighborhood levels, within some of the unions, within the nonprofit world, within the hospitals and universities, as in Cleveland, buying locally but buying from worker co-ops, I think that process over time, particularly given the economic failures and the pain and learning what's really going on in Washington, I think that process is like the prehistory of the progressive era, the prehistory of the populist era, the prehistory of the New Deal. I think we're laying down a foundation which ultimately I think is going to have the possibility of becoming very serious politically. So there's a lot of work to do now, and I wrote America Beyond Capitalism partly to give people access to some of these models and some of the theory of it. And so what you can do, the real question is what can we do back home right now in Detroit or Racine, Wisconsin, where I'm from, building for the future and laying down this foundation for much larger things to come.
Yeah, I don't think people realize, at the time of any of the historic periods that you mentioned, the Civil Rights Movement or the New Deal, that people realized that they were at the beginning of a historic period and that would actually be named, because we never know what history is dealing. And in fact, it really becomes up to us, the whole idea, we can either be objects of history and just be acted upon, or we can actually become the subjects of history and make history ourselves, because everyone that we, lionize as the heroes of a particular movement, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, what have you, they're just ordinary people that stepped into a breach that was there. And I'm sure because of the atomization, the political atomization of people, everyone's, there are a lot of people, at least listening, think, well, I don't know, that sounds good, but what can I do? I'm just sitting here driving my car and listening to the radio. America Beyond Capitalism gives a lot of suggestions, but how do we move people from that atomization to an understanding that that our future lies in our work together?
Well, I definitely think you're right. I do think we're at the beginning of a historical era, and I think I think people are beginning to sense that. That's what it wasn't only Occupy that what was interesting is how many millions of Americans said, "Hey, they're right. Something's really wrong." It wasn't just these kids. I think the way you go forward is it's very simple, and all things start with small groups. All things, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, it's always that way. The way the women's movement did it was, call together five or six women in the living room and the civil rights movement and get some coffee or some pizza, read a book, find out what can be done, because all over this country people are doing things. This website we have, community-wealth.org, or my book, America Beyond Capitalism, tells you about what other people are already doing that you actually can do. And, sit together and say, is there something we could do to start? And that's the way all movements start. That's how history is made. I think none of this is about economics in one sense, and none of it's about politics. It's very personal. What are you, or what are I, or what are we personally actually willing to do? So it's an existential question. The ball always ends up right square in your own court. It's not about them out there. It's about, I'm going to take a shot at it, and I'm going to do something, and then see whether we can make some hay. And I think, it's personal and existential. And I think you're absolutely right. isolation, you can break that by just getting together with folks. And then knowledge, you can learn about that from books and websites and what other people have done. And then look around, you'll see there's a lot of people doing a lot of things, and you're part of something bigger already that just hasn't been communicated widely, but I think will be.
And it's time, and it's also time to end the show and thank Gar Alperovitz for being on the show. The book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And Gar's got a lot of websites. I'm going to have them all on mine. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, because I think what he's saying here is extraordinarily important. You can go to community-wealth.org. You can go to AmericaBeyondCapitalism.com. And my website is Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
1, 2, 3.
Hear me home.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Wonder how many in this audience remember a book called We Almost Lost Detroit. If you've listened to the interviews I've done with Harvey Wasserman, a critic of the nuclear industry, you've heard us mention that. If you know the Gil Scott-Heron song, We Almost Lost Detroit, it's about nuclear power plant in the 60s down I-75 in Monroe. And then there's Fermi 2. So, I don't know. Where's Fermi 1? But we know there's Fermi 2. And now Detroit Edison is proposing to build Fermi 3. Because, hey, do we want to have all that bad coal poisoning us and fracking to get this gas out of the ground? So there's a lot of people that think, man, nukes might not be a bad idea this time around. Well, as you can imagine, and I'm sure if you've listened to this broadcast for a long time, I think it's an absolutely terrible idea. And we're going to bring back to our microphones Michael Keegan. He's joined us over the years to talk about nuclear power in the Michigan area. He lives in Monroe. He's at his office right now. He's co-chair of Don't Waste Michigan. Five groups have banded together to oppose the building of Fermi 3. Michael Keegan, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Hello, Peter.
Yeah.
Good to be with you.
So there's so many questions, I hardly know where to start. We almost lost Detroit. That was 1965, was it?
1966, October 5th.
Okay, and so we didn't. So we got Fermi 2. Where's Fermi 1?
Fermi 1 is located on the same nuclear complex right next door to Fermi 2.
Wow.
And Fermi 1 is still radioactive, still leaking tritium and radioactivity. And actually, just a couple of years ago, it caught on fire again. The sodium, they were pulling sodium out of the piping and spontaneously combust, and they had themselves a fire. So something that they did 40 years ago is still haunting them. Bad idea. Fermi 1 was a bad idea, and the whole primary objective of the Fermi 1 was to produce weapons-grade plutonium.
Wow.
It was a bomb factory. What they told the public was power too cheap to meter, going to produce more energy than it consumes. They didn't tell us, by the way, it's really to make plutonium for weapons. So they had a core meltdown in 1966. But even before the core meltdown, the reactor was leaking into the environment from 1962 and still continues to leak into the environment. It was pretty much decommissioned, disassembled from 1973 to 1975. But of the pool of workers who took it apart, they all died of cancer, cancers of the organs, liver,
really?
And kidney. But the unions who sit on those records, they don't want to talk about it because they think they can squeeze another job out of the new and improved Fermi 2 nuclear plant. So that was is up and running currently.
I mean, they would get jobs to decommission it because it's sort of its life is almost over, isn't it? Fermi 2.
Well, Fermi 2 went commercially operating in 1988 for a 40-year license,
okay.
And in a couple of years from now, they're going to look to get a 20-year license extension from the regulator, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Well, the regulator's been captured by the industry. They are a lapdog, not a watchdog. And
yeah.
It's problematic. What the regulator does is runs interference, keeps the public from being able to scrutinize the utility, and business as usual. And it's all about the pursuit of the almighty buck. The health of Monroe County is fairly bad. Prior to the Fermi 2 going online, the cancer rate in Monroe County was lower nationally than the average. And since the Fermi 2 has gone online, it's gone from 16% below average to 31% above the national mm-hmm. average.
So, Mike, you've lived there all your life. I mean, do you have personal worries about it, personal concerns?
I certainly do, but I live here. This is my community, and I'll be damned if I'm going to move for them. I'm about 7 miles as the crow flies, and unfortunately for the Canadians, the dominant wind patterns blow their way, and I'm actually west of the plant a little bit.
Well, we're safe way up here in Detroit, right?
Well, imaginary. It's illusionary. The radiation will stop at the 10-mile parameter and wouldn't think about crossing over unless they got, some kind of an okay from Mother Nature, and then they drift your way, waft your way. It all depends which way the wind's blowing, what are the weather patterns, and so forth.
Well, tell us this, and I should reintroduce you. I'm talking to Michael Keegan. He's co-chair of Don't Waste Michigan, part of a coalition of five groups that are opposing Detroit Edison's plan to build Fermi 3 if Fermi 2 is cranking along and can possibly get a 20-year extension. You say that the regulatory agency pretty much in the pocket of the industry. Why do they want Fermi 3?
Well, because it's a matter of greed, not need. They're greedy. This is very lucrative for them, their corporation, because the whole – we hear talk about a nuclear renaissance. The nuclear power is coming back. It's a renaissance. Well, the whole renaissance is predicated on the utilities being able to get guaranteed taxpayer loans at the federal level, basically a loan from the public.
You and me.
Yep. And then also to then come to the state and tell the state regulators that we need to charge ratepayers while we're building this thing, because in doing so, we'll be able to cover the cost of our capitalization and we'll keep the price down low. Well, just yesterday, the Toledo Blade reports that the price tag on the Fermi 3 is at $15 billion.
Huh.
There's not a need for the power. The demand is going down, will be going down through the year 2020. But they see this as an opportunity they're chasing money. And they know that the regulator is not a regulator. They're a cheerleader, and they boost, and there's no application that they will deny. Every application for a relicensing, 71 for 71, has been approved, even though there's been opposition at every one of these relicensing, raising serious contentions. They all get shredded, and they all get sliced and diced and dismissed by the regulator, the legitimate governmental entity that oversees this, who answers only to Congress. Well, you know, Congress, who's Congress answering to? You know, they're the PAC monies. So it's a very convoluted process. I don't have a lot of faith in Congress doing the right thing. I certainly have no faith in the NRC doing the right thing. So it is up to public. The public are the regulators. And what we have is public embarrassment. All we can do is dig out documents and show them how ludicrous this is, and just through satire demonstrate that, you know, the emperor has no clothes.
But Michael Keegan, let me ask you this, and maybe this is a terrible analogy, but Monroe, Michigan, where you live and where the fight against Fermi 3 and 2 and 1 is taking place, is also the home of George Custer, sort of the classic loser in American military history. And the way you have it posed, it sounds, now I'm totally mixing metaphors, yeah, that David doesn't sound like he has a ghost of a chance against Goliath. I mean, if you have the regulatory body is in the pocket of the industry, if Congress is going ahead with this, if the liberal president of the United States puts forth nuclear energy as a good alternative to foreign oil, maybe you all ought to just quit. Stop proposing it.
Well, maybe I should quit. I don't think so.
okay, that's the answer I wanted.
Maybe I can't change them, but they're not going to change me.
Yeah.
And I will bear witness. The anti-nuclear movement is an abolitionist movement. This is a very oppressive technology. Its origin, its genesis is in the pursuit of nuclear weapons, and the nuclear power is the smiley face of the peaceful atom. And it's killing us. I mean, we're killing ourselves to be able to kill other people, but in the process, the weaponeers and the profiteers are making money hand over fist at our expense. It's just a bad way to produce. It's a bad way to boil water.
Well, tell people that. People don't realize that it's no mysterious process. Just instead of, you know, putting something under your tea kettle like gas or electric, they're using nuclear power. Essentially, what's happening is just steam is being generated to turn turbines, right?
Correct. Being a very complex process of splitting the atom to boil the water, to create heat to boil the water. But in some countries, they boil water with the cow dung.
Uh-huh. And so what we have alternative technologies. You know, the good news is we don't need this crap. We have renewable energies of solar, wind, geothermal. And the cheapest route to go is what's called a negawatt. Negawatt. That is, you save a watt of energy rather than produce it. And you do that by weatherizing homes through energy efficiency, changing out old furnaces, and providing the kind of incentives to do that. That's the low-hanging fruit. But the problem in this nation and around the world is that energy is used by a conduit by which resources are funneled from you and I, the ratepayers, on up to the capitalist owners, the stockholders of Detroit Edison. And they pursue energy technologies in the most – they pursue capital. They're not pursuing energy that's efficient. They're pursuing energy that's going to yield the most financial benefit for them, and it's exploitation. I would say it's more like a feudal economic order, that we're the serfs and they're the overlords, and what they decide we got to go with. It's a monopoly, and our relationship to utility is characterized by one of dependence and indebtedness. I just heard a presentation last night. There was a big meeting in Monroe. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission called people out to make comments on the environmental impact statement, the draft environmental impact statement. And one of the presentations was made by Michelle Martinez about all the cutoffs that have occurred in Detroit area. In 2009, 200,000 people had their energy cut by Detroit Edison. And her point was that the rates are so high that people can't afford it. Now, if you build a $15 billion nuke plant and bring that into the rate base, what's that going to do to the people who are, you know, on the cusp of being able to, you know, it's heat or eat, heat or eat. And we really don't have a choice in who we can get our energy from. They're natural monopolies. And every time the cartel, it's attempted to break up the cartel and deregulate and allow other people into the market, the utility does their lobbying in Lansing, and they throw some money around, basically our money they throw around, and they buy themselves some politicians who capitulate. So anytime there's any kind of a progressive deregulation, the utility turns the policy around.
Let me say that I'm talking to Michael Keegan. He's co-chair of Don't Waste Michigan. Their website is dwmi.homestead.com. I'll have a link to that on my website. You can also go to beyondnuclear.org. We've interviewed people from that organization before. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show, and Michael Keegan is telling us about the effort to stop the building of Fermi 3 at a minimum, and at the maximum is to rid the U.S. and the world of using nuclear energy as a power source. That there's lots of alternatives. You know, you mentioned what it turns out to be in a way almost a blackmail. What are you going to do, heat your homes or eat with poorer people in our area? But there's another blackmail as well. Do you want to be unemployed, or do you want to build a nuclear plant? Do you want to be unemployed, or do you want to build the Keystone Gas Pipeline from Canada through to the U.S. Gulf? So tell us a little about the unions that are involved. They, of course, are looking forward to any construction, right, regardless of what is being built. Tell us about their role in it.
Well, it certainly is economic blackmail. As I say, we were at there was a large meeting in Monroe yesterday on the draft environmental impact statement, taking public comment. Well, the utility lined up all their lackeys, and they all came forward, and they talked about jobs and tax revenue and what a good neighbor and what a, you know, a philanthropist the utility is, and how they are charitable, and they do all these good things. Well, they do all these things, good things, with our money. The jobs would be localized jobs, but the bang for the buck is terrible. I mean, $15 billion invested in renewables and alternatives, you're going to get six times as many jobs as you would in putting all this capital and equipment into a nuke facility. And building the nuke facility, actually most of that $15 billion will be leaving the state.
Why would it be leaving the state?
Well, because the equipment is produced elsewhere, large components, the large engineering firms, and we're talking General Electric, we're talking Lockheed, we're talking Black & Veatch. It's who's who's of corporate raiders, so it's economic blackmail. They dangle this little carrot out to the community that thinks they're going to get these jobs. Most of these jobs would be people coming in from elsewhere. They're not going to be local folks. There may be 1,000 jobs for people locally, but the majority of those jobs are going to come from outside. Once they have if the plant were to ever be up and running, those people operating the plant are not going to be from Monroe. But it's a community that it has been captured by the utility. It's the largest fish in the tank. 60% of Detroit Edison's assets are in Monroe County. They call the game. They call the shots. They control the county commission. They control the city council, and they're bullies on the playground. And everybody's got to suck up to them. And anybody with a kind of a backbone finds themselves outside the. We fight the good fight.
What's the city administration of Monroe? How do they feel about it? Are they welcoming or are they?
The mayor made a presentation last night that city council supports a Fermi 3. Well, gosh, I didn't see any resolutions coming before the city council calling for an endorsement of Fermi 3. And the afternoon session was led off by the chair of the county commission, who said, oh, the county commissioners support a Fermi 3. I didn't see any resolutions going before the county. I didn't see the public having any opportunity to speak. So it's all this behind-the-scenes manipulation, meetings before the meetings, quorums that are beyond the Sunshine Act, private meetings, shenanigans, that type of thing, and that's how they get it done. Detroit Edison is the quasi-government. They're the shadow government behind the county commission, behind the city council. They're not going to like hearing this, but, they all suck up, and Detroit Edison, jobs. Well, look what they're doing in the community. They've got the largest coal burner in the world when it was built, the Monroe Power Plant. Just the air quality of Monroe is terrible. They got the Fermi 2, which perpetually leaks. They had the Fermi 1, which had a core meltdown. And here comes their brilliant idea for Fermi 3. And sucks up.
Maybe they can get BP in there to do some work. Hey, Michael Keegan, in light of Fukushima, the meltdown in Japan, it looked like the fortunes of the nuclear industry were taking a nosedive. But social memory, political memory, is pretty short among most people. How has the Japanese situation impacted the concerns?
Oh, geez, this is a pretty complex story. We all live in Fukushima. It's here with us. The Fukushima reactors are the exact same design as the Fermi 2. Actually, the Fermi 2 is the largest of that design. It's a General Electric Mark 1 reactor, largest of that design. And that design was known to be faulty in 1972, and the Atomic Energy Commission, the predecessor of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, suppressed that information because there were internal memos they talked about to bring these things forward would be the death of nuclear power. So rather than to put a recall on this design, we'll just not issue any more licenses and have them move on to a different design. TEPCO was the utility, it's as if the nuclear is God King. Everybody has to serve the nuke. They are above everything. TEPCO told the government what to do. The government asked them to put water on, to put seawater on. No, they refused to. They have captured the governmental entities. They are God King, and everything's sacrificed to the nuke, sacrificing liquidators at Chernobyl. 800,000 liquidators went in to put out that fire, to clean up that mess. Japan, the same situation is going to occur. Human life can be sacrificed to the God King of nuclear power. And there's a conspiracy of silence. General Electric, these were General Electric reactors, and basically the same design. There's 23 GE reactors of the same design operating in the U.S., Fermi being the largest. And the utilities that they have, because of General Electric, there's a conspiracy of silence. General Electric, Westinghouse, Hitachi, media coverage, the blackout, the very little information is coming out of what's going on in Japan. We've got to get it through independent media sources, through back channels. And so they want to present it, oh, it was a tsunami that did it. An earthquake followed by a tsunami, the probability of such a thing occurring is infinitesimal. No need to worry about it here. Well, basically in Japan, what happened was a station blackout. They lost power, backup power to that station. In the U.S., at the Fermi 2 in 1988, a raccoon sent the plant into a station blackout, shorted itself out on an electrical bus, took the plant down. In June of 2010, a tornado hit the Fermi station blackout. If your backup power does not kick in, then you're on your way to a meltdown. And for 20 years at the Fermi 2, the emergency diesel generators were improperly configured. And what was going on was all this equipment was hooked up on the circuitry calling for these emergency diesel generators, but if it were needed, they would have failed because there would have been too much load on it. And for 20 years this went on. And this is one of the most inspected components at a plant. So the utility themselves missed the inspection for 20 years, missed finding it. And then the NRC signed off, does a paper audit, signs off on it. And for 20 years this went on. And then finally the utility discovered it, and they reported to the NRC. And the NRC says, well, since you voluntarily reported it, there's no harm, no foul, no fine. So it's a regulator that is just toothless, and they're a facilitator, an enabler.
This isn't certainly something we don't, and I know you don't mean it is this to be symbolic, but this is something that in many ways our future depends upon, and what the health of our community. So this is extraordinarily important. There's been a whole period of passivity in American politics for the longest times, and that's why the corporations and the 1% are riding so high. But with the advent of the Occupy movement, and people are beginning to question authority in a very, very dramatic way, all the concerns of the Occupy movement seem to be on everyone's lips. What can we do? What can listeners do? What can we hook into to make sure that this dangerous technology gets put away? And you should maybe in answering say, we can't just stop. We could stop coal burning tomorrow, right? But nuclear power is the gift that keeps on giving, right?
Well, that Occupy movement, they're everywhere. They showed up in Monroe last night, and they read a statement, and all the polite politicians were just, and the NRC, they just flabbergasted. basically, they told the NRC that they were criminals, and I'd have to agree with them. Everything they had to say seemed to be quite accurate. So that Occupy movement is a godsend, and we are the 99%. But the good news is renewables of solar and wind are ready now. The invisible hand of the market. Adam Smith's about to show up. And unless the major cartels, the utilities, are able to suppress wind and solar, they're going to get surpassed by this. So it's time for them to move in that direction. And actually, Detroit Edison has moved to build some wind farms and some solar, and I commend them for that. But they need to do that at an accelerated rate, and they're only doing it because they're forced by a renewable portfolio standard at the state of Michigan, which went in a couple years ago. Unfortunately, it's the weakest renewable portfolio of any state in the nation, calling for 10% by, I think, 2015.
Oh.
But we can do much better than that. Germany.
Well, before, we do have those examples. Unfortunately, we're completely out of time. This discussion must continue. If you want information, you can go to Don't Waste Michigan's website, dwmi.homestead.com. There'll be a link on my website as well. Or you can go to beyondnuclear.org. Michael Keegan is co-chair of Don't Waste Michigan, one of five groups coalition opposing the construction of Fermi 3, calling for the alternatives which are there, alerting us to the dangers of nuclear power. As always, Michael Keegan, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much, Peter. Keep on keeping on.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Hey.
Back to the rock.
Starts fine.
101 The Riff.